at 10:01 here in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org. This special presentation produced and hosted by Gary Noll. And we're happy to have you in the studio on the line with us this morning, Gary, with this very special program looking at America as a police state. Good morning, Gary.
Thank you very much, Michael. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share this. This is going to be an eight-hour special. We're doing this for one reason, and that is because more and more Americans are concerned about what is happening to our rights, our freedoms. It is also, secondarily, to help this wonderful station that has been a beacon of truth and justice for decades, over 55 years. And instead of having another full week fund drive, which was planned, a full 24/7 fund drive, I was asked, would I do a special? And I thought, what would be a special that would be in alignment with WBAI's principles and its character and its charter and its mission, and that is to speak truth to justice. Therefore, we've lined up quite a marquee of some of the most important advocates for human rights and social justice in the world. And they'll be on every hour. We will be reading commentaries. We'll be doing interviews with individuals and that have been pre-recorded. And also, we will be doing some pitching. And our premiums are in direct alignment with the programs. We'll be offering Police State, The Shredding of American Democracy, The Lords of Wealth, The Unseen Power Behind America's Collapse, Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State, and Intervention, what we have done over the last 100 years in the name of peace, freedom, and democracy. Well, it's anything but those things. But these are important CDs. They're each different and with different specialists and giving us different views of the problem. So that's why we're doing this today. My hope is, our hopes are, that we'll raise enough money today for the station that it will preclude us from having to do a seven-day, 24/7 fund drive at a time when it is best not to do that. Because when you do these fund drives, there's always a risk of losing the attention of the audience. And with so many other vehicles for people to listen to, we cannot afford any more loss of audience. Our hope is to actually increase our audience and raise some money for the station. All the money goes to the station, by the way. All of the people involved have donated, as we always do, our time and energies, resources, and scholarship to the station. Let us begin, Michael G. I'd like to welcome everyone to a special broadcast on America as a Postmodern Police State. I'm Gary Noll. Joining us later this hour will be John Whitehead. John Whitehead is an attorney and author who has written, debated, and practice widely in the area of constitutional law and human rights for the persecuted and the oppressed. He founded the Rutherford Institute, a civil liberties and human rights organization headquartered in Charlottesville, Virginia, and he gained international renown as a person who was able to go up against many of the major governmental agencies and win. He has filed numerous amicus briefs before the U.S. Supreme Court and has been co-counsel in several landmark Supreme Court cases as well. And we'll be discussing with him his views on what has become a postmodern police state in America. I'd like to begin our program today, however, with a commentary from Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges' article is entitled A Society of Captives, and Mayor de Blasio plans to launch a pilot program in New York City to place body cameras on police officers and conduct training seminars to help them reduce their adrenaline rushes and abusive language, along with the establishment of a less stringent marijuana policy, are merely cosmetic reforms, according to Chris Hedges. The killing of Eric Gardner in Staten Island was, after all, captured on video. These proposed reforms, like those out of Washington, D.C., fail to address the underlying cause of poverty, state-sponsored murder, and the obscene explosion of mass incarceration, the rise of the corporate state, and the death of our democracy. Mass acts of civil disobedience, now being carried out across the country, are the only mechanisms left that offers hope for systematic legal and judicial reform. We must defy the corporate state. It is my contention that we should not work with that corporate state, and that is why many of you have heard on many occasions on my radio program, I have suggested and I am opposed to reform because the people who are creating the reform bills are the problem. They have lobbyists who write reform for them. Therefore, we hear of reform, but when the reform actually manifests, there is so much wiggle room, there is so much ability to compromise it, that it means nothing. And yet the public, once again, has been lulled into this state of feeling, okay, something was done. No, something was not done. Not what needed to be done. We need to challenge forthwith the corporate Democrat, Republican, the corporate liberal, and the corporate conservative establishment and the hold they have on America's legal system. Now, that legal system no longer functions to protect you and I, ordinary citizens. It serves our oligarchy, corporate elites. These elites have committed $26 billion in financial frauds. They loot the U.S. Treasury, they escape taxation, they drive down wages, they break unions, they pillage pension funds, they gut regulation and oversight, they destroy public institutions, including public schools and social assistance programs, they wage endless and illegal wars to swell the profits of arms merchants, and yes, authorize police to murder unarmed black men. Police, national intelligence, and security agencies, which carry out wholesale surveillance against the population and serve as the corporate elite's brutal enforcers, are omnipotent. By intention, they are designed to impart fear, even terror, to keep the population under control. And until the courts and the legislative bodies give us back our rights, which they have no intention of doing, things will only get worse for the poor and the rest of us. It is my contention that we now live in a post-constitutional era. Now, corporations have captured every major institution, including the judicial, legislative, and executive branches of the federal government and the state governments. They've done that through ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. We now know, having operated in secrecy for over 25 years, that they were personally responsible for meeting with state legislators and writing more than 22,000 bills that became laws, and we never knew it. So any time that there was a law passed within a state that deregulated an industry, coal or something else, or imposed additional restrictions on the public, behind the scenes was the hidden hand of the 200 to 300 largest, most powerful corporations in America, members of ALEC. Now, our state legislators knew what they were doing was immoral. It was not illegal, but it was immoral. They knew that they were breaking the basic trust and bond, that when they said they'd be representing we the people, that they were meeting in secret at exclusive resorts twice a year, and they were being coached by these specialists from ALEC. They were given the bills. They didn't write a single word of the bill, but they acted as if it was their bill. And then these were passed. It is my belief that every one of these bills should be rescinded and every politician that met with ALEC and did their bidding should be shamed. They should be recalled from office, and those that are no longer in office should be held accountable ethically and morally for the crimes of omission that they imparted. Corporations now control everything. They have in the process demolished civil society. Carl Polanyi, in the Great Transformation, warned that without heavy government regulation and oversight, unfettered and unregulated capitalism denigrates into a mafia capitalism and a mafia political system. A self-regulating market, Polanyi writes, turns human beings and the natural environment into commodities. This ensures the destruction of both society and the natural environment. The ecosystem and human beings being objects whose worth is determined solely by the market. They are exploited until exhausted or collapse occurs. A society that no longer recognizes that the natural world and the life on it is sacred no longer has the intrinsic value beyond monetary value and commits collective suicide. Such societies cannibalize themselves. This is what we are undergoing literally as I speak. As in every totalitarian state, the first victims are the vulnerable. And in the United States, that means poor people of color. In the name of the war on drugs or the necessity of enforcing immigration laws, those trapped in our urban internal colonies are effectively stripped of their rights. Police who arrest some 13 million people a year in the United States, 1.6 million of them on drug charges and half of those on marijuana counts, were empowered by the war on drugs to carry out random search and sweeps with no probable cause. They take DNA samples by force and then put it into a national database that includes both the guilty and the innocent. And they charge each of the sampled arrestees $50 for the DNA processing. They confiscate cash, cars, homes, and other possessions based upon allegations of illegal drug activity and use the proceeds to swell police budgets. But then it gets worse. They have been able to confiscate in the last 12 months $2.2 billion, more than 10,000 cars, more than 1,000 homes, and many businesses. The problem is there were no crimes committed. These were random stoppings of people, and the police say, "How much money do you have?" The person says, "Well, I'm going on vacation, so I have $2,000. Give me the $2,000. Why? Because I believe that you got that $2,000 with the intent to buy drugs. I don't do drugs. I have never done drugs. I'm on my way to vacation. Here, here's the withdrawal slip from my bank. We don't care about that. Give us the money or you'll be arrested." So the person hands over the $2,000. Yesterday, by the way, it was $50,000. A man was going to an auction to buy equipment. Police stopped him, took $50,000 in cash. Now, were any of these thousands upon thousands of Americans charged with a crime? Not one. Given a ticket, a summons? Nothing. They had committed no crime. Yet the government brags about $2.2 billion in asset forfeitures. It gets so bad that if a trooper likes your car, they can take your car. And most Americans who do not have that experience could never appreciate the extremes to which the government can now go to get it. So yes, they confiscate cash, cars, homes, and possessions without due cause, without legal proceeding. They simply steal it. When they do pose fines, it's generally in poor neighborhoods for absurd offenses. For example, if you're poor and you're sitting, you can be arrested, you can be fined. Now you're going to have a record, and now you can't get a job. If you're homeless and you're living in your RV, they can give you a citation. If you're homeless and you're wanting to spend the day in your car because it's cold outside, that's an offense. In over 70 cities in the United States, they've now made it illegal to be poor and in public. You cannot feed the homeless. You cannot care for the homeless. Even riding a bicycle on a sidewalk or not having your ID on you, if you're stopped, that's how they fleece the poor. If they cannot pay, you're tossed in jail, and you're charged every day for being in jail. And before deporting undocumented workers, the state levels fines, often thousands of dollars, on those being held by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agencies in order to empty their pockets before they're shipped out. Prisoners locked in cages often spend decades attempting to pay off thousands of dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, in court fines from the paltry $28 a month they earn in prison jobs. The government, to make sure it gets its money, automatically deducts a percentage each month from their prison paychecks. It is a vast extortion racket run against the poor by the corporate state, which also makes sure that the interest rates of mortgages, car loans, student loans, and credit card loans are set at predatory levels. Since 1980, the United States has constructed the world's largest prison system. At any given day, you have over 2.3 to 2.5 million inmates. That's 25% of the world's prison population. Police, to keep the system filled with bodies, have had most legal constraints on their behavior removed. They serve as judge and jury on the streets of American cities. Such expansion of police powers is a long step down the totalitarian path, so said U.S. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas in 1968. The police, who are often little more than predatory armed gangs in inner-city neighborhoods, arbitrarily decide who lives, who dies, and who spends years in prison. They rarely fight crime or protect the citizen. They round up people being, well, much like you would round up cattle. Why? To meet quotas, arrest quotas. They're prerequisite for receiving federal cash in the drug war. And because many crimes carry long mandatory sentences, it's easy to intimidate defendants into pleading out on lesser offenses, even if they're innocent. The arrested are acutely aware they have no chance. 97% of all federal cases, 94% of all state cases are resolved by guilty pleas rather than trials. An editorial in the New York Times said that the pressure employed by state and federal prosecutors to make defendants accept guilty pleas, an action that often includes waiving the right to appeal to a higher court, is, quote, closer to coercion than to bargaining. There are always police informants who, to reduce their own sentences, will tell a court anything demanded of them by the police. And as we've saw after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson and after the killing of Garner, the word of police officers and prosecutors whose loyalty is to the police is law. A Department of Defense program known as 1033, which was begun in the 1990s and which the National Defense Authorization Act allowed, along with federal homeland security grants to the states, has provided $4.3 billion in military equipment to local police forces, either free or on permanent loan. The website ProPublica reported this. The militarization of the police, which includes outfitting departments with heavy machine guns, ammunition magazines, night vision, sniper rifles, aircraft and armored vehicles, has effectively turned urban police and increasingly rural police as well into quasi-military forces of occupation. Last year, American police conducted 80,000 SWAT raids in the United States, up from 3,000 a year in the early 80s. The American Civil Liberties Union found that, quote, almost 80% of SWAT team raids are linked to search warrants to investigate potential criminal suspects, not for high-stakes hostages, barricades, or active shooter scenarios, and frequently they do nothing more than try to arrest or arrest people who owe money. So now you could have a SWAT team break in your door and arrest you because you didn't pay a bill, because we've returned to the 1800s with debtors' prisons in 27 states. And these debtors' prisons are unlike anything that the average American in their lifetime or their parents' or grandparents' lifetime ever thought possible. These debtor prisons will pick you up, as they did one woman from the South who had a parking ticket of $45. She was unemployed at the time, living with her parents, so she was arrested. She spent 3 days in jail. They charged her over $130 a day for being in jail. They then assigned her a privatized probation officer that she had to see on a regular basis. But each time she saw this probation officer, she was charged more money. She had to pay administrative fees to the sheriff's department. In all total, it was over $700. And this is a booming business with millions upon millions of Americans caught up in the privatization scheme. It is thriving. And yet, frequently, as in the case of Texas, a person who actually sits in the state legislature was appointed to oversee the, for example, the payday loans and the usurious rates, actually owned payday loan institutions. And the same goes for the private prison system. People from the system are then put in charge of overseeing the system. There is no outside independent bodies. So the bodies of the incarcerated poor fuel our system of neo-slavery. In prisons across the country, including the one in which many people from this radio station and from this audience have heard, Rikers Island and Queens House of Detention, for example, the incarcerated are able to work 8 hours a day for as little as a dollar a day. Phone companies, food companies, private prisons, and a host of other corporations feed like jackals all those held behind bars. And the lack of employment and the collapse of education and vocational training in communities across the United States are part of the design. This design, with its built-in allure for the illegal economy, the only way for many of the poor to make a living, ensures rates of returning to jail of over 60%. There are millions of poor people for whom this country is little more than a vast penal colony. By the way, it is not in Rikers that people actually do this work, but in the state prisons and federal prisons that I'm referring to. Lawyer Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, identifies what she calls a criminal caste system. This caste system controls the lives of not only the 2.3 to 2.5 million people who are incarcerated, but also the 4.8 million people on probation or parole. You're dealing with nearly 7 million Americans who have been impacted negatively. Now, that's just them. Now, if you have four people per family, you're dealing with almost 28 to 30 million people adversely affected. Millions more people are forced into permanent second-class citizenship by their criminal records, which make employment, higher education, and public assistance difficult or impossible. Totalitarian systems accrue to themselves omnipotent power by first targeting and demonizing a defenseless minority. Poor African Americans, like Muslims, have been stigmatized by elites in the mass media. The state, promising to combat the lawlessness of the demonized minority, demands that authorities be emancipated from the constraints of the law. Arguments like this one were used to justify the war on drugs and the war on terror. But once any segment of the population is stripped of equality before the law, as poor people of color and Muslims have been, once police are permitted under the law to become omnipotent, brutal and systematically oppressive tactics are invariably employed against the wider society. The corporate state has no intention of carrying out legal reforms to curb the omnipotence of its organs or internal security. They were made omnipotent on purpose. Matt Taibbi, in his book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of Wealth Gap, brilliantly illustrates how poverty, in essence, has become a crime. He spent time in courts where wealthy people who had committed documented fraud amounted to hundreds of millions of dollars, never had to stand trial, and in city courts where the poor were called to answer for crimes that, well, I didn't even know existed. Standing in front of your home, he shows in one case, can be an arrestable offense, just standing in front of your own home. Quote, "That's what nobody gets, that the two approaches to justice may individually make a kind of sense, but side by side, they're dystopia, where common city courts become factories for turning poor people into prisoners, while federal prosecutors on the white-collar beat turn into overpriced garbage men who, behind closed doors, quietly dispose of the sins of the rich for a fee. And it's evolved this way over time and for a thousand reasons so that almost nobody is aware of the whole picture, the two worlds so separate that they're barely visible to each other. The usual political descriptors like unfairness and injustice don't really apply. It's more like a breakdown into madness, end quote. We have been warned by many people within our society that once any segment of the population is denied rights, the rule of law is destroyed. When laws do not apply equally to all, they are treated as rights and privileges. When the state is faced with growing instability and unrest, these so-called privileges are revoked. Elites who feel increasingly threatened by the wider population do not resist the temptation to deprive all citizens of legal status and rule them with an omnipotent police. This is exactly what, in my opinion, is taking place right now. The corporate state and its organs of internal security are illegitimate. We are a society of captives. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to welcome you to a special edition. The special edition today is discussing America as a postmodern police state. We're now going to go to a guest who is standing by who has some very important insights into this topic. I gave you his background biographical information earlier. He is John Whitehead. He'll be speaking with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Nice to have you with us today, John.
And John will be on in just a moment. I anticipated going to Chris Hedges straight away, but John will be with us in about 2 minutes, Gary.
Okay, then what we will do is this. We will now hear from Chris Hedges on the issue from Fascism, Inc., his perspective.
Today, live in studio, is Chris Hedges. Two people I'd like for you to give your thoughts on. I watched what I consider the single worst display of arrogance in the media was when Bill Maher and Michael Moore got down their hands and knees begging Ralph Nader not to run because he couldn't win and he was going to lose it. And my thought at the time was, I said how appalled I was because I said, take a look at this. Ralph Nader created 227 pieces of legislation from the Environmental Protection Agency to the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, that have were the law of the land. As not a legislator to do that, no human being before or after in American history has ever caused that many pieces of legislation that were pro-consumer. And yet, they're saying he is a dinosaur, he no longer is important. And I'm thinking, if Ralph Nader were president, we wouldn't be in Iraq. We wouldn't be in Afghanistan. We wouldn't have had the bailout of Washington because we wouldn't have had the evisceration of the Glass-Steagall Act. He would have stood strong on principle. He would have gone to the American public and he says, do you realize what's happening here? And he would have educated the public as he did when he had that opportunity and did so brilliantly. And I'm thinking, gee whiz, now I heard Bill Maher the other night and he is lambasting people. He's being vile and crude, demeaning people who doesn't agree with him. And then I'm thinking, why can't Bill and Michael see that if they looked at what it means to be a progressive and not just a defender of the democratic values, that this election would have swung differently. We'd have different types of candidates. And yet that is what has happened if you stray away from the party line. If you're not a good Democrat, then you're fair game. I see the same people on Rachel Maddow, the same people. Same people on Ed's show, same people on though Rattigan, I think, is a little different. I think he's more capable of allowing people with different points of view on. Same people on Keith Olbermann. So I asked my audience, for 1 week, watch these shows and tell me if you remember anything that anyone said. It's vacuous.
Yeah, it's vacuous.
3.5-minute comments.
Yeah, and it's all around whatever the hot button issue of the day is, and Fox is just doing the same thing from a different angle.
Yeah,
you're right. It's completely vacuous. I spare myself the distress by not owning a television, so I don't have to watch this stuff.
Let's talk in the remaining 7 minutes we have. I'd like for you to talk about four areas that I'm concerned with. I would like your opinions on how so many Democrats have become kowtowing to the Democratic principles, the Huffington Post among them, that I don't believe is progressive at all, and a lot of people calling themselves progressive that are not, labor unions, universities, and religious institutions, and how they have refused to rise to the crisis in our society and to get people out and focus with constructive anger for constructive change.
Well, this is, of course, what, you know, I tried to go back and chronicle in this book, Death of the Liberal Class, where I went back to World War I. Because on the eve of World War I, we had powerful socialist, communist, progressive movements that had terrified the power elite in this country. And Woodrow Wilson used the war to break them. He created the most efficient and sophisticated system of mass propaganda in human history through the Creel Commission, crossing all sorts of mediums, not just newsprint, but graphic arts. If they had a film division, they had 45,000, they called them three-minute men, who fanned out across the country to sell the war to the public. And it was a fascinating moment and a terrifying moment in American history and in modern history, because it for the first time implemented the understanding that Le Bon, Freud, and others had, Trotter, that people were not moved by fact and by reason and by rational argument, but could be manipulated by emotion to actually carry out all sorts of policies that not only were not in their interests, but in the case of the First World War, was a tantamount to collective suicide of young working men in countries like Germany, France, and Great Britain, and finally the United States. And so that the actual measures of overt repression, which were taken against the field holdouts, people like Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams and others, was relatively few. And they essentially, at the end of World War I, we entered a new paradigm, which was the permanent war economy, constant fear. The hated Hun was replaced by the dreaded Red. And liberal institutions signed on for this. And they very ruthlessly purged their own, destroyed the Wobblies, destroyed the CIO. Well, who did it? Well, of course, those figures within liberal institutions who were the most morally bankrupt and the biggest careerists. We saw it within the universities. We saw a slight resurgence of the left in the 30s with the collapse of communism, and then ruthless witch hunts that extended into the 50s and 60s. And then we saw the rise of unfettered capitalism, globalization, which is a utopian ideology, the idea that the marketplace is going to determine human behavior. There's nothing in 3,000 years of economic history to justify this absurdity. And liberal institutions had been so denuded, so destroyed, that they lack the capacity for independent thought, lack the capacity to resist. So that we have now come down to this end point where the walls are falling down around us. And those who purport to defend liberal values, the gulf of their hypocrisy is just staggering and I think increasingly not lost on the mass of American people. The very things that they claim to defend, they make war against. And Clinton is a perfect example of this, but you know, so is Barack Obama. So are the heads of labor unions that spend all of their time negotiating away pensions and benefits and wages and rights for their workers. The press, we've talked about. Universities have been utterly corporatized. And so that the voices of sanity have been really pushed to the outer edges of society and lack the systems of mass communication by which to reach out to a confused and angry electorate.
Now that was Chris Hedges. Now let's go over and say hello to John Whitehead. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Gary.
John, contributing to our special today on America as a postmodern police state, I'd like for you to start off with the idea that at the moment, police brutality and the free get out of jail pass police officers now receive it's just simply wearing a badge, is receiving a... it allows people to commit crimes without any sense of accountability. And underlying all that we are learning about, the militarization of police departments and the rise in police killings of people committing minor petty crimes or even innocent civilians. Some people are mentally handicapped, and even children are being arrested, tasered, or killed. There is this blanket of secrecy that pervades our entire government and justice system as well. And mainstream media doesn't report this. For example, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court just recently reauthorized the National Security Agency's collection and surveillance of phone records. And everything that was said, done, in the cloud, even historical messages. Now, none of this was reported. And while it is evident to a growing number of listeners and Americans that the U.S. has now entered a very dangerous condition that has made our votes and liberties and the illusions that we live in a democracy obsolete, there's also the aspect of secrecy that is a fundamental characteristic of a police state and a nation that is heading towards totalitarianism. So please address the extent of secrecy that now pervades the quarters of political and private power, and why we should be very deeply concerned about this. And then the second issue to segue to is that the police state or totalitarian regime sometimes emerges in order for a ruling elite to implement exclusively a particular ideology while excluding all opponents of that ideology. Nazi Germany, Stalin's Soviet Union, Mussolini and Franco's regimes are examples of this. However, our emerging police state seems to be more founded upon power, money, and domineering influence instead of a clear and certain ideology to trump all other political orientations. So could you address these two issues, please?
Yeah, I think the first thing to understand is that the United States is ruled by, you know, I want to call it a corporate elite, but it really is the corporate state. It's the merging of large monetary interests with governmental interests, as we all know. In fact, when you're voting for a politician today on a national scale, you're voting for a corporation because they fund the candidates, which basically says, and you said it, democracy as we've known it or a free government really doesn't operate that way. In fact, there was a Princeton study that came down not too long ago, which basically concluded that America is ruled by an oligarchic elite, which is the moneyed interest. The fact that you vote, those kind of things, the study basically said is meaningless now because whoever rules the system gets their way. And they have a very powerful face on the corporate state, and that's the militarized police we're seeing across the country and all the things we're seeing coming down that situation. We do live in a secret government where the NSA is downloading everything you do electronically, from your bank records to your tweets to your text messages. At the Rutherford Institute, we're involved in the cases. We see people being arrested, and we've helped some that have been arrested and taken from their homes for anti-government or anti-Obama Facebook posts. So they're watching it. The NSA recently called, and NSA alerted a Alabama school about some kid who did a silly post, and the kid was called in the office. They're watching the Facebook posts of high schoolers. With through fusion centers, where there's over 70 of those sprinkled around the country, where they're watching everything from they're downloading the information that the cops are using from their Stingray devices, which are fake cell phone towers that operate within their cars, to license plate readers. There is virtually no privacy. It's what Orwell said in his book 1984. You have to live as if you're in, you know, everything you're doing is being listened to or watched. So that's the present lay of the land. Its technology is moving so rapidly, and people have to understand this. This is key. Google admits working with the NSA. Amazon just built a $20 million intelligence cloud for the 17 intelligence agencies. They work closely with them. Google is working with DARPA to build robotics, the Atlas IV Android creature, the drones. And drones start flying over America in January. They're going to eventually, in my opinion, rule the skies. They're going to be armed. They're going to have scanning devices. Again, this is a $30 billion a year industry starting next year. There's a lot of money to be made off of these things. So the average American by the way, is watching 150 hours of television a month. That's just television, not other screen time, entertainment distractions. So we're much like Aldous Huxley said, we'll probably be smiling at Big Brother. We are smiling at Big Brother, by the way, in my opinion. So I think that's the lay of the land. We live in a, what I call an electronic concentration camp in my book, The Government of Wolves, where if you make the slightest mistake or you become a troublemaker like Gary Null, you're going to be watched. And if you make the wrong kind of mistake, you can be rounded up or a SWAT team can come to your home. As you know, Gary, there are over 80,000 of those occurring across the country each year, 80% of them for warrant service, where a policeman used to show up at your door and knock on the door and hand you the warrant. Now they're coming through your door. So you, I think, mentioned something about Nazi Germany, and I've studied Nazi Germany carefully. It looks like we're using their blueprint. I don't know if you know, but there was a big meeting right before Hitler came to power of all the industrialists, and one of the industrialists walked out of the room. And they asked him, what was the result of the meeting? And his statement was, we just hired Hitler. I don't know if you know that, but that's actually a quote from history. So this thing that we're dealing with now has been operating throughout history for many, 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 many years.
John, what role has the growing government-funded and subsidized private military-industrial complex and private intelligence firms had on transforming our local, city, and state law enforcements into an arm of Washington's totalitarian control to limit America's democratic acts and liberties?
Well, what you're dealing with is, Eisenhower gave us the warning about the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex is not over in Afghanistan. It's not over in Iraq or Pakistan. It's here. We have a standing military army right now on American soil. I don't know if you recently saw in Dallas, some of the residents were quite freaked out by all the black helicopters flying overhead. Special Forces operation working with police, but that's been happening across the country. What you're dealing with here is you have a standing army, which the founding fathers who wrote the Constitution screamed against, don't let it happen. We now have a standing army operating here, which can put down rebellions. That's why I talk to American citizens who say they're going to grab their gun and go out and fight. I tell them that even small local police departments have enough firepower now to blast any kind of rebellion off the map. So the military has been brought home. And one of the dangerous trends I'm seeing is the police today, local police, whatever, they're being treated like they're heroes before they do anything. If one of them dies of old age, they have funerals. They're highlighted in the newspaper with flags. They are treated like the military used to be treated, let's say, after World War II. So that's on American soil now. You have a standing army which will shoot you, which will raid your home, which will, take you away. I mean, and you know all the cases. I'm sure you've had them on your program, little kids getting shot, old fellows, 76-year-old man with a cane getting shot by police. Things that used to, if it would have happened in the 1950s or 1960s, would have been national stories. Now it happens on a daily basis, and the courts give the police qualified immunity, which means they're not held accountable for basically anything they do. And if there is a reward, let's say someone wins an award against police brutality or whatever, it's the American citizen that pays for it. So that's what you're dealing with. I would like to give people good news, but I don't see any good news. And what I'm telling people is we have a very short time. Drones are going to, in my opinion, within 10 years, if drone technology becomes more sophisticated, and it's already sophisticated, they'll be able to lock down the country or sections of the country within 24 hours. Working with the police, the so-called hive mind now where your cell phone, your laptop, your so-called driverless cars, they have those come about. By the way, there's no such thing as a driverless car. Someone's driving. They're all going to be reporting your activity. In my state here in Virginia, the police have already said they're going to begin using drones for traffic control. They're going to be flying over cars. They'll have scanning devices, facial recognition devices. They'll know how fast you're going, whether your seatbelt's on, probably, depending on the type of automobile you have. So that's the lay of the land. I think we have, like I say, about 5 to 10 years if we don't take action now and turn this thing back.
John, the newest high-tech television sets that are on the market, the big flat screens, if you read the instructions in the small print, it lets you know that they are videoing you. There's a camera in every television.
Yeah,
there's
they have face recognition software.
Face recognition. Plus, they have audio. They're listening to every word said in the room.
Yeah.
So this, and it also says in that contract that no one ever reads that they can share this information with third parties.
Yeah.
So now they can watch every single thing, listen to every single word you say in the privacy of your own home. The average American generally has two televisions. Some have three. From your bedroom where you have a television, in the living room, sometimes in the kitchen. So they're monitoring. Also in all new cars, anyone who has the tracking device that allows you to see, you know, where you're going also is being tracked. They also have audio recognition in the car. So anything stated in a car can be recorded. They can know exactly where you're going. So why would they need this? Why have there not been any open and honest discussions? Why couldn't they have a discussion saying, we intend to monitor every action of you as a citizen. We believe we have the right to do so, and then we, the people, have a right to challenge that. They do all this in secrecy, supposedly with the president. How'd that work out for everyone who was going to make change? Yeah. There hasn't been one single act I can count upon that this man did that does not benefit the special interest groups. But he and all other people in power know who is on the other end of giving back the favors. The most wealthy president in history, wealthier than all other presidents combined, Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton will seem like chump change compared to what the money's going to be flowing when it comes to Barack Obama being out in a private citizen. We'll probably see the first time, except for, I think, George Bush Sr. With Kuwait. But I will see people regularly getting million-dollar speaking for small selective groups. No one gives you $1 million as a guest speaker unless you've done a big favor. And generally, I saw the ratio is 1,000 to 1. For every dollar that lobbyists give, they get $1,000 in contracts or preferential treatment that supports their bottom line in return. So here's what I'd like for you to address. This is an abstract question in this sense, because it's purely subjective. Why is the average person in the media not reporting on this? You have an exception like James Risen of the New York Times, but all the rest of the media are mute on this point of the fact that they now have drones, and you said the technology is advanced. It's more than advanced. They have drones now that are the size of mosquitoes.
Yes.
All right? They can fly into a person's room. They can photograph and record everything in there, and you would never know.
You have the hummingbird drone.
The hummingbird drone.
Yep.
So people wouldn't even know a lot of these drones. You would assume they're an insect or a bird.
You won't know if that bird sitting in the tree outside your home is really a bird, no.
They also, and I first reported on this in over 15 years ago, and I remember I reported on this on my ABC Sunday Night Show, and I got a lot of feedback on it. People said, well, that's just conspiratorial nonsense. I said, no, it's not. There are now vans going up and down streets all throughout the United States, and they have the technology capable of seeing everyone in a home and listening to your conversations in a home with this special type of equipment. And it was absolutely correct. That later came out under freedom of information, that they've been going up and down streets all across America to see what people were doing, what they were saying, and it wasn't just terrorists or someone that we threatened. It was normal surveillance, and that's old technology now compared to what they're capable of doing.
Yeah, the drones will be equipped with that same type of technology, yes.
So why aren't the media, why aren't the average Americans, why aren't people living on the Upper West Side, the most concentrated group of citizens of wealth, success, power, academic achievement in the world, from 57th Street to 115th Street, from Riverside Drive to Central Park, you have the greatest concentration of power, wealth, authority, and these people are not asking the hard questions. Why?
Well, it's called the corporate media. You know, there's six mega corporations that control everything you see. So, and they're geared toward entertainment, making money. So they're not going to report the news. Anything that might disturb the average citizen, and most of them fall in line. I mean, here's the thing. Most people are into politics, and I keep telling people politics doesn't work. Politics is conquer and divide. as long as you're screaming and yelling about whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or whatever you are, you're going to be lost in the system. You have to understand that the people running the government, Barack Obama is an emperor. He does whatever he wants to do. He golfs. He does whatever he wants to do. He is the king of America. He's treated like a king. The worst mistake we ever made was having a White House, in my opinion, and putting people in it and treating them special. The President of the United States should be treated just like we are, but we treat them like a king, and now they hide in secrecy, and they're funded, and they get all these perks. Obviously, they're going to take these things. So the people in the corporate media, I've done a lot of television interviews. Most of the stuff, I mean, I was on a huge show not too long ago talking about civil liberties issues. The thing that preceded me was people eating chicken wings, and I couldn't figure out how people eating chicken wings correlated with what I was saying. It doesn't. It just didn't seem to make any sense. But that's where we're at today, and most Americans are sitting blindly watching that stuff. I often say this. If you have a complaint about the country, look in the mirror. What are you doing? That's the key to freedom. Freedom starts with the individual. The only way we're going to take this thing back, number one, I know we don't have a lot of time here, but I've got to say this. You're going to have to get groups together in your local communities and basically take over your city council meetings and have them nullify things the federal government's doing and fight back. The other thing we're going to have to do, and maybe you want to talk more about this, Gary, is Martin Luther King's tactic of militant nonviolent resistance, and that's what he called it. He was planning on shutting Washington down right before they shot him and getting very, very radical, but he said they no longer listen to us. What he understood was how you get government to move positively in your direction is by making government expend energy. Unless you do that, they don't care what you're doing out there, whether you're yelling, voting. You have to show them that you can do mass protests that will basically shut government down. Otherwise, no one's going to listen. They're going to continue to make money. But I don't see a lot of hope as long as Americans are sitting and watching television 150 hours a month. I don't know, Gary, what do you think about that?
I believe that we're not in enough pain as an entire society to get out of our comfort zone, to get out of our disconnect and care with compassion about the service that we should be serving each other. I believe that there are those who are in extreme pain, extreme dereliction, and have been, and I showed this in my new film, Poverty, Inc., these people have simply become invisible. You've got 15 million senior citizens living in abject poverty. You have 100 million Americans living at below the poverty line. You have 16 million hungry children. You have 2.5 million homeless school children. You have ghettoization of the American cities and the suburbs. And yet, we will only look at that which is profitable. And that's wrong. My final question for you, John. So I don't see anything changing until such time that the person who has been safely and comfortably ensconced in their gated community or their apartment, when they are affected, when enough of them are affected, who do you not see at the demonstrations? You don't see the most exclude with a few hand, just a handful. I could count them on one hand, of famous people who are also socially relevant. The vast majority of the 10 million millionaires in the United States, the 1,500 billionaires, the 30 million people in the upper middle class, the 7 million professional class, lawyers, engineers, architects, you never see these people as a group. You never do. You never see the going on strike to protest social injustice or student loans of professors at universities. And we only had one, and it just took this year to have it at Berkeley, and that was only because the students protested the increase in tuition from last year to this year. But they didn't protest what was more important than their tuition increase, the student loan, the debt peonage that come from it, the usurious rates that are tacked onto that, the fact that once they get into that debt peonage, they can go into a debtor's prison. They never addressed any of that. They should have had a general strike of all college students. I'd like to see every college and university in America shut down We wouldn't lose one single point on our IQ scale or relevance until such time that all these laws are changed and this debt is forgiven and you're allowed to file bankruptcy and you stop and take out of business payday loans and all their usurious loans. If the banks get loans at 0.2% interest, then everyone else should get it the same. The maximum any interest should be is 1%. And that would what I would suggest.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the other thing is that people have to realize that I've done about a two-year exhaustive study of Nazi Germany. Up until near the end, there were nice shops operating. People were living well in Nazi Germany, the so-called landed class. They weren't saying anything. They didn't protest when they started rounding up homeless people. Then when they started up rounding up gay people, when they started rounding up this person, that person, social, what they called social deviants, then when they came to the door of some of the people who decided to speak out and had a little more money, there were some objections. But the problem I see is we're lulled to sleep. They're building the camps, folks. The electronic concentration camp is already built around you. And I guarantee you, when you have the Department of Homeland Security purchasing 1.6 billion hollow point bullets for their agents and other agents across the country, they're preparing for something. And hollow point bullets explode on contact. They violate international law. That's what agents are running around this country with in America. So they're getting ready for something. They fear there might be some kind of uprising. But we're going to have to use wise tactics. And I'm telling people, study the writings of Martin Luther King. He had a plan. It was a darn good plan. It shut down after he was killed. But his idea was to go up to Washington, create a shantytown, and shut it down so they would listen. The only way you get that jackass to listen to you, my dad once said, you walk around behind him, you hit him with a plank, and he turns and looks at you. And that's where we're at today, folks. So get active, get out there.
John, I have
one. If
you
think voting's going to change things, it will not.
No, not unless you're voting for a true independent Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein,
sure,
Dennis Kucinich. The people that really care and cannot be compromised in their moral
principles. But
the
problem is with the debates, they won't cover.
That's correct, but that's because we have not demanded.
Again, you don't get down with that local television station. If they're not reporting the news, if people are getting killed in SWAT team raids in your local town and they're not reporting that, get down and picket signs in front of that television station and demand that they wise up and start reporting the truth.
John, my final question. There are approximately 600 to 700 killings of civilians by police annually. Include all of the additional deaths that occur in prisons, and we are looking at around 1,500 deaths related to law enforcement per year. Now, certainly there are instances when an officer shooting a criminal is warranted. However, the rise of unwarranted killings by police officers is staggering, and many of these are technically manslaughter. However, officers and particularly murders occur during SWAT raids, and they're not being charged and prosecuted justly. The rule of being innocent until proven guilty seems to only apply today to law enforcement officers, and the victims are immediately deemed guilty. So in the wake of Ferguson and the death of Garner in Staten Island and other police shootings, innocent people around the country, what is the message that's being sent to the public when police officers are immune to the justice system? And with respect to the events and riots at Ferguson, what is the lesson we need to learn from this?
The lesson is you're moving into a totalitarian regime, or if I can use the word authoritarian regime, where the corporate elite, you want to call them the 1% or whatever you want to call them, their face is the militarized police. If you dare step out of line, they're going to punish you. That's the message you're being sent. The future is here. We're not going toward a police state. We're in a police state. We're not going toward a surveillance state. We're in a surveillance state, and it's totalitarian. I see the cases here with the people arrested. People who are just doing Facebook posts now are getting visits from the FBI, the NSA. They're being threatened with arrest, free speech. That's the type of stuff. We're on the cusp of something that's really, really dangerous. And like I say, I think we maybe have 10 years if everybody gets active, but, Gary, I'm afraid I don't see that. I hope these protests over Garner and the shootings continue, If they stop, it's going to be very, very sad.
I appreciate all the good work that you've done on behalf of the American public. My guest concluding here is John Whitehead. He is an attorney. He specializes in constitutional law and human rights issues. He goes after those who have been persecuting and oppressing innocent civilians. He is the founder of the Rutherford Institute, which is a nonprofit civil liberties and human rights organization down in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he has filed numerous amicus briefs before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he has co-counseled in several landmark Supreme Court cases as well. He's been on 60 Minutes, and his most recent book is In the Government of Wolves, the Emerging American Police State. His website is rutherford.org. Thank you very much for being with us today, John.
Hey, thanks for your good work, Gary.
John Whitehead. I'm Gary Nall, and you're listening to a special edition, America is a Postmodern Police State. Now, let's go into our studio in New York City and say hello to Michael G. Haskins. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Gary. Good morning. And that was really quite powerful from John Whitehead. Always interesting to have him on the line, hear his insights, hear the discussion that you have with him.
Well, now what we can do is the reason we're doing this 8-hour special today, and each hour, different guests, different themes, different topics, it's all involving the same thing, how we become a fascist nation, and yet probably 90% of Americans are not aware of that because they're distracted. He mentioned television, but there's a lot of ways we distract ourselves and don't want to know the truth. We can't bear that truth. Even the truth that the majority, there's a big article out here today that shows that the majority of people supporting torture and even deaths from torture are Christian fundamentalists. And non-religious Americans are opposed to torture. So we're not looking at these issues as we should. We need clear, honest voices in this discussion, and we're not getting them. So what we've done, we have taken a lot of time to prepare some special premiums. The premium we're offering today in this hour is called Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State. Now, the people you're going to hear in here include Professor Sheldon Wolin, quite simply one of the greatest minds in America involving the myth of American democracy and the emergence of inverted totalitarianism. Professor Joanne Galtung, and he talks about the fall of the American Empire. He traces the entire history of our empire, and then what is taking its place is a neo-fascist state, and how can we return to a true republic? He discusses that. Chris Hedges, the demise of true liberal values in America and the rise of fascism. Professor Norman Pollack is talking in here about the failures of democratic radicalism in preventing the U.S. from descending into fascism. We have also Professor Andrew Colin on the conflicts between state power and democracy and the history of the U.S. turning into a police state. Ray McGovern, always of interest to the people of this audience. He worked for the CIA for decades, and he talks about the role of the CIA in surveillance and the emerging police state and how they're behind it, and the moral imperative for citizens to become activists. Professor Henry Giroux, the role of the media and our educational systems in the creation of authoritarian fascist minds. And I also do three different one-hour commentaries. So it's a large package. It's the largest we've ever done. It's 10 hours. 10 hours in this one CD package called Fascism, Inc., and everything is timely. Everything is up to date. But we step back and don't just look at the headlines. You see, when you listen to a lot of the radio programs and television programs, even Al Jazeera that does some really good programs on this, they're capturing the headline, the moment of the headline, the people involved. And I believe that we should have a step back and look at the larger context in which this is occurring. Larger context. So when a Bill O'Reilly and the other people over at Fox and there are other voices come forward and say, well, you know, these people are dangerous and the environment's dangerous. Who are these people? These are human beings. And what environment? So let's take an example of the environment. How did Newark, how did Camden, New Jersey, how did Compton, California, How did all these places, these 200 ghetto cities, areas around the United States, how did it get that way? So I went to these places. I filmed there. I interviewed hundreds of people in each location. I spent days on those streets, including mean streets, including where in every single street you had a different gang. And I just told the gang members, I said, look, I'm here to bear witness to your story. How did you end up in this gang? What happened here? Camden, New Jersey used to be a thriving city with the biggest shipbuilding in the United States in Camden, New Jersey, major RCA Victor. The big sign is still there, Campbell's Soup. It was all there. Gainful employment. They had almost no unemployment. They had a good quality standard of living. And then it became the outsourcing, shipping jobs out of the country. It became the corporate raiding, taking over corporations, stripping off its assets, and firing people and moving off to India. If it was a clothing factory, move it off to Bangladesh. But no one tells that story. No one tells how did we get to where we are today. You know, I told the audience the other night at the Quad, and we had 35 showings of the new film, Poverty, Inc., and I said, do you all believe in women's rights? Yes, they all did. I said, do you all believe in social justice for women? Yes, we do. Would you do anything that caused women to be suffering unnecessarily? No. I said, okay, now let's take a look at our clothes. And I pulled over and I said, my shirt is made in the United States by union labor. Where's your clothes made? And suddenly there was this silence. So I said, can I look at your color? And the woman said, yes. It was made in Bangladesh. So I said, you know, I'm sure you've spent a lot of your time helping on important issues. But did you forget that every time you buy a dress, a coat, something made by slave labor, 14 cents an hour, under harsh conditions, with the lowest life expectancy of any work group in the world, the bricklayers of India, including the kids and the garment workers in Bangladesh, have the lowest life expectancy. I said, we're contributing to that. Shouldn't we be conscious of that? When you say you're against globalization and yet you shop in a Walmart, you say you're against multinational neoliberal policies, yet you eat at McDonald's. Why are we so disconnected, including on the left, including the people who, in my opinion, should know better? They have the sensitivity. They have the political awareness. They're certainly smart enough to know that how in the world can you condemn something by supporting it? That's utter hypocrisy. So in each one of these discussions, the people that I just mentioned pull back and show the larger historical context. How did we evolve to where we're at? This is a real history lesson. This is a social studies lesson. This is a political philosophical lesson. This isn't just a pound the fist or the gavel down on the current headline. That everyone's doing. That's why I never do that. I want to get the larger message out. So that's what it is. Michael G., 10-hour CD set, Fascism, Inc., and it's meant to support this wonderful station. And over to you.
That's right. Fascism, Inc., by Gary Null. It's a $150 contribution, a tax-deductible contribution to WBAI. When you are considering your end-of-year giving, please consider this. Fascism, Inc. This is a special presentation. It is hosted and produced by Gary Null, and we're offering this right now. We're asking you to go to your phones, dial the number. We have some folks standing by at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. That is the number to call. Fascism, Inc., $150 contribution. Also joining me in studio this morning, Gary, is Kathy Davis, and she is here with us to encourage all of you listening right now to do one of two things, either call that number or visit us online. We're looking at it right now online at Give2, that's the numeral 2, Give2WBAI.org. But the other number, or the number, is 212-209-2950. Kathy.
Yes, thank you. I'm so happy to be here today because this is such an important program, and I'm excited about the protests that are starting to take place with regard to the shootings in Staten Island and the police violence. But this is a program that is going to really tell you why this is happening, how it came to be, and how the state that we're living in is truly a fascist state. So all those people who were out there during that march need this information. We need to be able to educate people so that they can understand what we're dealing with. The number is 212-209-2950. It's only a pledge of $150 when you make that phone call. But think, you're getting 10 CDs, a wealth of information, and an education on the true state of America, of the United States, of the police state, and truly, we have to wonder who's running our government. Well, this is an opportunity for you to find out what's really going on behind the scenes. 212-209-2900 is your number to call. When you make that phone call.
That would be 50, though.
Oh, 50. Yes, sorry. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. And you can use your debit or credit cards when you make that phone call in order to make your pledge of $150. It's really not very much when you think about the quality and the quantity of information that you will have, not just to educate yourself, but to share. Take it into school. Share it with your professors. Share it with the students. We all have to be educated so something can be done to change the world and the direction that it's going. 212-209-2950. And WBAI Pacifica is one of the few resources still available publicly right here on the air for people to be educated and to find out what's going on. We need for you to support this radio station, 212-209-2950.
And you heard what John Whitehead was saying as he was in conversation with Gary Null, talking about, I mean, it's not just the state of the union, where we are, the real state of the union, but he offered up some serious solutions of what we could do, what citizens can do, what you and I could do. Take over these city council meetings. Talked about the news entities that we listen to and look at every day, if they're not covering these issues as they should be doing, as WBAI does regularly, then we have to call them on the carpet, call them to account. We have this radio station here, as Gary said at the beginning, 55 plus years of commercial free broadcasting, thanks to listeners just like you. Now, we're taking this time so that we didn't have to go through a full week of fundraising at this particular time. By the way, happy Hanukkah to everyone out there who's celebrating and observing. Thank you so much for tuning into our broadcast today. It is Fascism Inc., Fascism Inc., $150 contribution, tax-deductible contribution to WBAI at 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or give to WBAI.org. That's the numeral two, give to WBAI.org. Okay?
And keep in mind, we just presented an entire hour with no interruption.
Right. That's right.
No pitching, and we believe that to give as much information as possible. You heard from Chris Hedges. I did a commentary. We had our guest on, all on the same larger theme, each with a different perspective on it. I'm just looking at the facts for what I can find, and I'm concerned about it, and I believe that we should be doing all that we can to support a grassroots effort to make real change. I mean, authentic change from the grassroots up. And we can do a lot of things. We can start to write articles, share the articles over the Internet. We can look for those documentaries out there. Danny Schechter has done numerous documentaries on this. And Glenn Greenwald, we can support the new Citizen 4 documentary that just came out on Snowden. Isn't it interesting that the person from the CIA who exposed corruption inside the CIA is now in prison.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But all the people who committed crimes, including murder, are not being charged. And when I think of the idea that what if you, either you, Kathy, or you, Michael, or anyone else who committed a crime,
an egregious crime, one that anyone would assume is a crime. And what if, when you were caught, you said, look, I think we know why now this crime was committed. Let's just put this behind us and go forward. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to walk out of here today. There's not going to be jail. There's not going to be record. There's not going to be anything. You think, well, hold on a second. What court in the United States would allow you to walk out and say, I've learned a lesson. Let's end it right here. And that's exactly what the President of the United States did when it came to George Bush, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, and at least 100 other people who are co-conspirators in intentionally, with malice aforethought, lying by manipulating the intelligence to say that there were weapons of mass destruction. Look at the consequences: a million dead, over 5 million displaced, the destruction of an entire environment with depleted uranium, and 6 trillion dollars total indebtedness. Over 5,000 dead Americans, over 50,000 injured, over 900,000 suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, over 24 Americans every day who are service personnel killing themselves at their own hand, and yet he says, let's look forward and go forward. Well, if you're going to do it for them, then you've got to do it for everyone, and we're not. We're not willing to even allowing a guy who's committed no crime, he's got a little bit of marijuana in his pocket, and he's walking down the street minding his own business. He's stopped and searched. He goes to jail. His life is disrupted. Everything is turned upside down. So if you're not willing to give any allowance for forgiveness, if to the contrary, if you do 700,000 searches in 1 year in New York City for stop and search, and it's 98% African-American or Latino, you're not doing any stop and searches in Wall Street. You're not doing any outside of Broadway theaters. You're not doing any outside of synagogues. So if you're not willing to stop and do the same stop and frisk outside of a synagogue as you would a mosque, outside of a white Christian church as you are a black Baptist church, then it's racism, it's bigotry, and it has to be called out. But if we want to be politically correct, we're afraid of whom we might offend, so we don't call anything out. And those who do call it out are not given any credit because they've already been marginalized. So if you have the truth on your side, you're marginalized, so nobody will listen to you. And if you have lies on your side, then you're immortalized as someone who cannot be held accountable. So we simply give a amnesty to every single person that commits any crime at the FDA, the people who wanted Martin Luther King to kill himself, and we have that proof. It's now absolute 100% proof. Not a single person from the FDA, from the FBI was ever held accountable for that crime, and that was crime, but there were many people committed it. Operation COINTELPRO, no one was found guilty. All of these major undercover operations, not a single government agent's ever gone to jail, and right now, no matter what crime someone commits, they're not held accountable. So at what point do we stop playing a game and say, either we're all held equally accountable in the eyes of the law to crimes and misdemeanors, or no one should be? But we've made it very specific. If you're an agitator, if you're an activist, you're spied upon. You heard the guest say, someone like me, now imagine I'm up against Big Pharma doing the documentaries. The most watched documentary in history on the internet is The War on Health, then Seeds of Death, up against Big Agra. I'm up against the FDA in Prescription for Disaster. Gee whiz, wonder what kind of file they must have on me. You know, they must have a platoon watching me. All right?
Pretty big, I would imagine.
But all I'm doing is telling the truth. And you hear me say constantly, let them come and debate me if they feel that I've stepped over a line and said something that is inaccurate, in which case I will either apologize, correct myself. But if they're not willing to come, they're not willing to debate. And what they do is in secret, and they listen to every phone call, they attend every meeting, they transcribe everything you say at every lecture to make sure if you make any mistake, they can use it against you. So what kind of society do we live in? Well, I'm calling out them. I'm calling out and I'm saying you are going to be held accountable. And so I've got to hold the fascists accountable, and they're all fascist. You can't say that you're not a fascist and do things that are fascistic. If you're not a fascist, then don't do something and don't support fascism. But these people have engaged in fascism, which is large corporate interest, working hand-in-hand with government policymakers to create policies that benefit those in power in the corporate world. That's fascism.
That's classical fascism, and that's what we have at every level of our society today. That's what we put in the 10-CD part series, and that's what we're offering. And where else are you going to hear this? The reality is you're not going to hear this on NPR, which I consider wonder bread for the brain. You're not going to hear this on PBS, dilettantes who all position themselves to get the next big paycheck and be invited to the next hoo-hoo meeting down in Washington, D.C. No, you're not going to have any of this. We already know how much power the Koch brothers have at PBS and NPR. Mm. We know how self-censoring has occurred. We know that the few brave and courageous minds that exist in both places, which there are always under some threat. I just spoke with one person who will remain nameless yesterday at length because of fear of wanting to do a special and then got called on the carpet because it was a special on, guess what, Seeds of Death. Not because there was anything inaccurate of exposing the crimes against our environment with genetic engineered disease, but because it would offend the Koch brothers, who are big sponsors. Mm. And this person said, what should I do? And I said, well, do you have another job lined up? No. Well, I suggest you get another job lined up, then go up and face and put it on the air, and then let them fire you, then make a story about it by having some reporters from Mother Jones or Atlantic or The Nation who will cover your being fired, and that will embarrass PBS, and that'll cause them to get into a predicament that they can't easily get out without losing a lot of credibility, and they'll be exposed. At some time, we must make a sacrifice in order to expose corruption and crimes against society. And that's where we are, and that's what Fascism Inc. does. 10 hours of exposing corruption crimes, but in a intelligent, reasoned, measured, historical, and larger social context. And that's why you won't hear. When was the last time you heard Professor Sheldon Wolum on any major media?
I can't recall.
And yet he is, without question, one of the leading progressive intellects in the world today. And he's an elderly gentleman, and we're fortunate to have had this interview with him. So that's what we're offering. Back to you, Tim.
That's what we're offering, and we're thrilled to be able to offer this morning. Kathy Davis and myself, Michael G. Haskins, here in studio. Gary on the line with us, and we have so much programming to bring to you. Let's give that number out again. It is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Already a few calls are trickling in right now, but we want a rush of calls. We have a number of people standing by at that number, ready, prepared to take your phone calls at 212-209-2950. The work is already done. It's packed. It's ready to go to you. Fascism, Inc., a $150 tax-deductible contribution to WBAI, supporting this station. And the most important thing, as well as give to WBAI.org, the most important thing, however, is to have the station here so that we can broadcast in the middle of the FM dial, three states, as well as the Internet. Broadcasting and narrowcasting, we're doing both because we have this vehicle, 99.5 FM, 212-209-2950, Kathy.
That's right, 212-209-2950. Fascism, Inc. is a revolutionary product. It's a revolutionary premium we're offering you today because it really does expose America and allows us to see, indeed, we're living in a police state already. We have the illusion that there's freedom, but the freedom isn't real. We're being restricted financially. We're being spied upon. We're being aggressively treated by the police forces. It's an amazing look at the real world and what most people have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And you may think you're safe from this behavior, but you really may not be, and it's important to know what's going on in the world today. 212-209-2950, and really look at this way that our world has been set up since 9/11, and how our rights have been taken away, and how this system, how this country has systematically been transformed into a police state.
Indeed,
Fascism Incorporated. It's only a pledge of 200 and $150 when you make that phone call of 212-209-2950. Just $150 pledge for these 10 CDs. And this is something that you can listen to. You can share with the people in your life, your family, your friends, your students, your teachers. Everybody needs to understand that we have to stand together and do something about this. I saw a lot of people on those protest marches over the weekend and over the last couple of weeks, really. The awareness is rising, especially in this city. And this is the time for us to jump on that and educate people on a deeper level about what's truly going on. And you can do that with this CD set, Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State.
This is a commercial-free station, a listener-sponsored community radio station that is WBAI. We're broadcasting at 99.5 on the FM dial, and you can connect with us online at WBAI.org. This is a special presentation of The Gary Knoll Show, America as a Police State. And as I'm looking at the news wires, Gary and Kathy, I see that Cuba has exchanged American citizen Alan Gross for three Cubans jailed in the United States. The prisoner swap is set to pave the way for a major overhaul of bilateral ties, potentially bringing an end to over five decades severed diplomatic relations. And I say that only in passing that later on this afternoon we'll have a report on that at about the 2 o'clock hour as we continue on, because this is an all day, all afternoon affair here. We're trying to raise funds for this station, this commercial free station, WBAI, Fascism Inc., $150 contribution. It's tax deductible. Consider WBAI in your end of year giving. 212-209-2950 or give to WBAI.org. Gary?
Thank you. How are we doing there, Michael?
I'm seeing the calls coming in, and we're just we're inching along here. We have about 7-8 calls that have come in so far, Gary.
Okay, good. All right, well, then let's continue on for another minute or two with this, and then we'll begin our next segment.
Our next segment, and that is 212-209-2950. Hearing about the drones flying in the United States in January, the previous guest, John Whitehead, talking about that. I mean, they have all kinds of really slick commercials on television now and on the Internet looking at drones, young people playing with drones and a cat running out of the way. And it's all very, very, very sweet. And, oh, this is interesting and it looks like fun, but it is surveillance.
We're and it's how people are being programmed to accept this behavior, to think that it's normal, that it's somehow going to keep you safe, when in truth it is not. And if you walk through any of the neighborhoods of New York City where black people and brown people live, you will see the surveillance there. You'll see these high towers. You see the cameras that are already there taking pictures of what's happening in the neighborhoods. And I'm sure it's happening really in all neighborhoods. If you look up at the streetlights, some of them have these little capsule on it, which is simply a camera that is taking surveillance of people walking about doing their everyday business. And it's very easy to think that you're not vulnerable, but believe me, it ultimately comes to everyone's door, and we all are going to have to deal with this. So it's best to educate ourselves now. It's best to know how to take steps. I thought that advice about going to the city council was a tremendous one. You know, maybe that's where the marches should be going. The number is 212-209-2950, and the program we're offering you is Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State. And I have to tell you, Gary Knoll has been working on not just this program, but on going against the status quo, about revealing the truth from behind the scenes for decades. And this is one of his more remarkable programs, I believe. And it's something that can change our lives if we listen to it and we start taking action to make changes. The number is 212 212- 209-2950. And there really is no alternative to educating ourselves and standing up and doing something about this. The alternative is really too terrible. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. It's a pledge of $150. That isn't very much. It's a 10-CD set, and it's a life-saving wealth of information. And the important thing is, those of you who listen to this station, I know that most of you get it, but when you have this CD set, you can share it with the people in your life who are not getting it, who don't understand why people are out in the streets, who don't understand why it's not okay for the police to use this kind of violence against citizens of this country. This is why this is so important. 212-209-2950. Your pledge of $150 allows this radio station to continue the work, to bring you the material that is being produced by Gary Null and the many producers of this radio station. We need to keep WBAI strong, alive, and on the air, because you're not going to find this on other media. In fact, media was the first thing to go down in this move towards fascism. Following the Vietnam War, they cut down any kind of real reporting of what a war is like. And ever since then, it's been a slow shutdown and manipulation and control of the mainstream media. And you're not going to find the truth there. You have to come to a station such as WBAI. And we need for you to support this radio station with your phone call. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. A pledge of $150 to support this radio station. And our gift of thanks is Fascism Incorporated, How America Has Become a Police State. It's a 10-CD set. It is a tremendous amount of information, very well researched. And you're going to be hearing from some of the real revolutionary leaders in the fight for liberty, true liberty, for each of us as American citizens. 212-209-2950.
Okay. What we're doing is we're in a whole day of sharing insights on how we become a police state. And Michael G., in a moment, we're going to go to Police State USA, the shredding of American democracy. And Kathy, this is brand new. This is with Professor Andrew Colin about the advancement of state surveillance and violations of privacy and spying on citizens. Interesting, it was on WBAI that I first mentioned 2 years ago, before the Snowden incident. It was about a month before the Snowden incident, that it was not just random individuals who had some possibility of being suspected of communicating with terrorists. It was every American had their emails, all of their electronic communications, not only captured but listened to, and it was analyzed. And they had a group of psychologists wanting to know what porn you watched, to know your fantasies, to know your weaknesses, to know your vulnerabilities. And I thought at the time when I got this information, who would want to know this except to blackmail people? And powerful, the average person could care less. But what if you're a very powerful person? What if you're a person, a religious leader? What if you're a very conservative political leader? Would you want people knowing something about you that would give them a different opinion of you, your moral character, let's say? And so I broadcast that at the time, and everyone said not possible. And I remember having a discussion with a person who's a hardcore BAI listener who said, you know, it's one thing to give information that, yeah, that there's some people out there who may be making a call to one of the Middle Eastern countries, but they're not listening to every call. They couldn't. It's not possible. I said, yes, they have the technology and have had it for years. They are capturing every single phone call, not just who you called, what time and what date, but the actual content of your conversation, your voice, another person's voice, your message, another person's message, your photograph, their photographs. They have it all. Not only do they have it all, but they've been cataloging it to see how they can use it against you. And then if you represent someone who is an agitator, if you're an academic and you're at a university and you're tenured, they'll use what they know against you to try to get the university to go against you and your colleagues to go against you and how the public will go against you. They're going to try to marginalize anyone who has the truth that could affect the business community or the government community. And now we know that all that is true and even worse. So whatever a person thinks about, well, what they're doing, it is measures worse than what they've actually done. We're just now finding out about it, and they want to make that a crime. So whistleblowing becomes the crime, not the crime that's being exposed. That is the irony. So you're also in this police state, USA, that this is our show we're going to do now. We're also going to hear about, from Kevin Carson, the militarization of local and state law enforcement and SWAT team policing. You're going to hear about media psyops and misinformation campaigns, how Americans become victims to government misinformation and oppression. Ross Caputi on a firsthand account of military and media psychological operations in Fallujah, Iraq. John Rappaport, the use of covert psychological operations to instill fear and misinformation about health. And Erica Baldadwin, the emergence of debtors' prisons and the social strategy to incarcerate the poor. And Darpana Seth on the rise of civil forfeiture. So we have all these experts. We have 8 experts in this 4-CD series, Police State USA, Shredding of American Democracy, that you haven't heard. And we're going to begin now in this segment. So, Michael G., if you're ready, we will begin right now. And let me just introduce the segment, all right?
Just 1 second
just,
before that.
Just before going out, I just want to give that number one more time. It's 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. And we're going to be featuring in this hour Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy. And it is an incredible series, as Gary was describing, and is about to give you just a little bit more information, exclusive interviews and conversations with some of America's most noted progressive civil rights attorneys, investigative journalists, and political scholars who have the courage to voice their opposition to unconstitutional policing of American citizens that is today transforming the U.S. into a militarized totalitarian nation. 212-209-2950, your $100 pledge of support for the 4-CD set, Police State USA.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is a special broadcast on America as a postmodern police state. In this segment, we're going to discuss Police State USA, the Shredding of American Democracy. And our first discussion will be with renowned journalist and activist, Glenn Ford.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. In this segment of our program on America's transition to a police state, we have Glenn Ford, executive editor of the Black Agenda Report and son of the famous disc jockey Randy Rutherford, the first black television host to have a non-gospel radio program in the Deep South. In the 1970s, he was a correspondent and journalist covering Capitol Hill and the White House for the Mutual Black Network, and later hosted the nation's first syndicated black news interview program, America's Black Forum. Since then, Glenn has been one of the nation's leading voices in political and social analysis and commentary on current affairs in the African-American community. He is also a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and a board member of the National Alliance of Third World Journalists, and is a frequent lecturer on the role of progressive media at universities. Glenn's program, The Black Agenda Report, can be heard every Monday at 11 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Nice to have you with us today, Glenn.
Thanks for the opportunity, Gary.
It should be clear for most progressives by now that the U.S. has formally morphed into a police state. Industrial state violence being conducted by domestic law enforcement, which is now being increasingly militarized, is essentially simply the manipulation of the rank and file in order to benefit an elite minority, that being the white class of corporate and economic individuals and their corporations. And for that reason, we find a disproportionate number of arrests and acts of police violence inflicted on blacks and other minorities. The statistics behind New York City's stop and frisk is a case in point. Police violence also increasingly targets the poor and those in poverty, which again is disproportionately African American and Latino. It is one thing to condemn individual police actions based upon racial prejudice, while not condemning the entire system of law enforcement. However, what we seem to be witnessing is an institutionalization of militarized policing that has more in common with dictatorial and totalitarian governments rather than true democratic governments. So I'd like you to speak on the social political regression from a more open democracy to that of a police state, particularly within the context of racial and class divides. And what do you perceive as being the fundamental characteristics that enable us to conclude that the U.S. has formally become or is becoming a police state?
Well, certainly by any measure, that is any metric that we could use, the U.S. Could be considered the worst police state in the world. It certainly has the highest incarceration rates of any state in the world by far. We have more people on any given day living in solitary confinement, 80,000, than almost all of the prison populations of the of any other nation in the world, 80,000 on any given day. But this begins, this modern era of mass incarceration begins with the black mass incarceration state, which is inaugurated in the late 60s as a response to the triumphs of the civil rights movement in the early and mid 60s. The first manifestation of it comes with the passage of an omnibus crime bill in 1968, a crime bill that was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson. It sets up the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the LEAA, which immediately began funneling tens of millions of dollars into local police departments. And that's not just in big, largely black cities, but even to rural police departments around the country. That was the beginning of the militarization, and it was in response to black people. The first SWAT team was in 1969, and its first mission was to launch a siege of the Black Panther Party's headquarters in Los Angeles. And today, there are 80,000 SWAT raids per year in the United States. By 1970, we see the incarceration rates jumping to fantastic levels, so that between 1970 and the early 21st century, the incarceration levels increased eightfold, and the ratio of non-white prisoners to white prisoners reversed. In the early and up until the mid-1960s, 70% of the prison inmates in the United States were white. Several decades later, that was reversed, so that 70% of the prison inmates are black and brown. And one out of every eight prison inmates on planet Earth is now an African American. So in terms of the raw numbers, in terms of the draconian nature of the sentencing, certainly in terms of the massive spying that the United States does, not just domestically, but against every population that is wired with the internet or with telephones, the United States ranks by far number one as a police state. It begins, however, with a mass black incarceration regime, and then becomes merged with a growing national security state. And the two are almost indistinguishable now.
It would almost appear that very little has changed since the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King. Dr. King stated, "There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of unspeakable horrors of police brutality." Would it be fair to say?
And the response is to increase the levels of incarceration, increase the levels of hyper-surveillance of the black community, and that's where mass incarceration begins. It begins with hyper-surveillance. If you look for crime, you will find it. And if you keep on looking for it and finding it and treating people as a criminal class of people, then you will create that situation.
Well, would it be fair to say that in most cases where the U.S. has tried to address the racial divides in this country, and there's certainly been individuals who have, including affirmative action, and Obama was supposed to be the affirmative action president, I would suggest that the government has failed. And because of its repeated failures, the recourse has been, as you state, to enforce a police state structure over different races and social classes in order to maintain its control and to protect those who are the, in their minds, the real minority groups, like Americans elite. Could you address the whole idea, the strategy to assure that the black-white divide remains and all other divides because this keeps a population weak and ergo easily to control? Is that reasonable or unreasonable?
Well, that line of reasoning would lead one to say that the American system of criminal justice is broken and has failed. However, another look at the situation would say that it's working just fine because that was the conscious response to the civil rights movement, that if black folks would not stay in their place, a place that was enforced during the days of Jim Crow by a rigid racial bar, well, then we will create a racialized criminal justice system that will have the same effect of controlling that black population. And in that kind of sense, then the system has not failed. It's working perfectly well, quite efficiently, horrifically efficiently. If there was never any intention to decontrol the black population, to allow for a racial democracy, then they have succeeded in changing the terms of the game, but not the end game itself. And in that, we see not just these terrible incarceration and police state characteristics in black America, but very much the same racial disparities economically as we saw 45 years ago. And in terms of wealth, the situation for black America has, in fact, deteriorated beyond measures of modern society. That is, the numbers in terms of black wealth are worse than they have ever been. 20-1, that is, the median white household has 20 times as much wealth as the median black household, which means that black America, on average, is far more economically insecure, as well as being worse off than white folks. It is infinitely less secure in that poverty than white people are. So in many ways, there's been a regression, certainly in the criminal justice arena.
In the last year and a half, I have traveled all across the United States for a film on Poverty, Inc. I've lectured in different places, Huntington, Long Island, just yesterday. Then I also lectured over in what had been considered one of the more utopian places in America to live, Sedona, Arizona, but also up in Northern California in Marion County. And what I'm hearing in the discussions with the participants and audience is that their areas are now being ghettoized. And I said, well, tell me what that means. What exactly does that mean? And let me just finish this thought. So I'm asking,
sure.
I'm asking them, what does it mean from their perspective that their area has been ghettoized? And without exception, it's about gangs, and it's also about the number of African Americans or Latinos who are now moving into their communities. And I said, so you consider the presence of a minority to be ghettoization? And their argument is, well, it creates this idea of poverty brings down the values. And in some places in the United States, it sounds insane, but this is the feedback I'm getting. We're learning of new state efforts at racial segregation. So from your perspective, in what ways is this mindset for the institutionalization of a police state and the biases of communities who've never been considered, let's say, a ghetto, and they want the African-American Latinos to stay in their place. How is this a road to fascism?
Well, you see, if the ethos of the majority community, if we're talking about white people, is that concentrations of non-white people are automatically bad and to be avoided, then of course any influx of non-whites brings down property values. Why does it bring down property values? Not because of anything that the non-white people necessarily do, but because white people move away from the area. So the bringing down of property values, and this occurs uniformly in the United States when black and brown populations come into the area, that is a function of white supremacy and white racism. It's not a function of some culture within black and brown groups or something inherent in those groups. We have a culture based on white supremacy that sees concentrations of affluent white people as being good, as representing economic progress, and concentrations of non-white people as being automatically bad. So you have this constant cycle of white people moving away and devaluing the property that they move away from. Now we see with inner cities the end of a cycle that began in the 50s, actually, and then accelerated dramatically in the 60s, where whites abandoned the cities, and there followed an abandonment of those cities by financial institutions, a disinvestment in the cities. When that no longer was sustainable, folks can't be moving 100 miles away from their workplace, then the finance corporations decided that they wanted to reclaim the cities. And reclaiming the cities did not mean that they would then make investments in the cities that would make it good for the people who had been there now for two generations, all these chocolate cities all over the country. It meant moving the folks of the cities out with no destination known. So that's the stage that we're now at, a stage of intense gentrification where black populations and even brown populations are diminishing in the cities with no alternative place for them to go. And so we find a scenario that you were just speaking of in these far off places, that people who are pushed out of the inner cities that they've that were left to them by default by white flight, now being pushed out to places unknown, and white folks in those places are now complaining that the ghetto is catching up with them. We hear, you know, all these stories. We used to hear them 50 years ago of communities reaching some kind of equilibrium at 10 or 15 or 20% non-white. And I remember being very young and reading newspaper accounts that said, well, this is the future. This shows that integration works. But in fact, those were just snapshots in time. Those communities became increasingly non-white as the white people left and became known as the ghetto. Now with gentrification, that ghetto, meaning black populations and brown populations, are coming to areas that were previously white, and we see the same thing happening again, and it's all because of the same engine. That engine is white supremacy and white people trying to create a space in which they are the only folks.
Glenn, many of us, I'm sure most of the people listening to this broadcast, certainly support and have participated, as I and others have, in the demonstrations against police violence. However, it is my hypothesis that this will not lead to major structural changes in the underlying causes of violence or police state. I do not see the demilitarization because of demonstrations nor policy changes in Washington, because they know that they will not have to yield power or change paradigms because of any form of racial protest. I recall reading an essay from Martin Luther King some years back where he stated that racial divides are not threatening to the state. Rather, it is a class disharmony that threatens the state, and class struggle, of course, became Dr. King's primary focus towards the end of his life, not only dealing with racism and police violence. So why is class struggle more threatening than racial struggle and disharmony? And do you feel that this is the real fear of the U.S. state now? And one last issue here. We have over 50 million poor working or unemployed whites who are armed. They do not go to these demonstrations. They will not be passive. I believe, and I hope I am wrong on this, that at some point in the future, when there's so much pain that we can no longer divorce ourselves by distraction from it, that there'll be possibly a home foreclosure. And the person will refuse to leave their home. And the marshals will call a SWAT team. The SWAT team will come in, kill the person. And then suddenly all hell breaks loose. I believe that what you're going to see is a major pushback, and a violent one, will come from white class struggle, not from a black or Latino or any other minority racial struggle. What are your thoughts on this, please?
Well, you know, I am certainly not the person to act as if they are an expert on white behavior. I do know one thing, and this is a characteristic that really sets the United States, at least in degree, if not qualitatively, apart from the other industrialized countries, and that is that U.S. social progress has been historically held back. That translates as the United States never having had much of a left spectrum. It's been held back by white people who do not understand their own class interests. And that has been a bulwark and a buttress of corporate supremacy, hegemony. In this country, if you predict that white people are going to somehow act out of form, that is, in terms of their historical behavior in the United States, that would be a great thing, to see white people act in their own class interest rather than what they perceive as their racial interest. But I can't be concerned with that because I'm no expert on white behavior, and I don't see any historical reason to believe that. We can only, in terms of the black movement, rely on our own efforts. And I believe that in terms of confronting this mass black incarceration state, it will succeed. It only has a chance of succeeding if it ultimately renders those cities and other areas of black habitation ungovernable unless the system responds. Ungovernable means certain levels of violence. We know that that will occur because the police will make it so. And that is an historical certainty as well.
My final question, I've done programs already on the extent of our private prison system and the increase of incarceration, primarily how it benefits corporate interest. You mentioned at the beginning of the program of over 2.5 million people incarcerated in the United States. We have over 80,000 solitary confinement, which is, for many of us, myself included, I believe it's a form of torture and inhumane. It doesn't help anyone. However, the prison system serves other functions in a police state. So please speak about the psychology behind the utilization of the prison as a means for aggressive social control.
By this point, after we're now on our third generation, the third generation of young black people is experiencing mass incarceration as a fact of life. It is understood by black youth in many neighborhoods that their almost certain destiny is long periods in prison. That exerts a huge psychological toll.
The Stasi on super steroids, or that NSA is now the new Stasi agency, simply because they're keeping this data, this files on every citizen in the United States and everybody on the planet that it can possibly get information on. So it's not just, it all started with U.S. citizens. That's why I had to leave NSA. I couldn't be a party to that. So I had to get out of the agencies that time. And it's only gotten worse over time. Bush was bad to start it off, first of all, going to the dark side. Like Vice President Cheney said, we have to go to the dark side. We never had to go to the dark side. There was no reason to ever do that. I mean, we had the capabilities to stop all kinds of terrorist acts. We just didn't. It didn't cost enough money, so they had to have programs that would cost money so they could build empires. And that's really what they were after. And that basically set the tone for all of the follow-on programming and the development of this super secret, top secret America that the Washington Post had published about a year ago. They had a three-part article called Top Secret America, and they listed all of the facilities that were built across the country to support the intelligence of collecting bulk data on everybody on the planet. And that really was what everybody was after in Washington, to build up a much bigger, greater intelligence community. And they spent, since 9/11, close to $1 trillion to do that. And that, to me, is the greatest threat to our democracy since our Civil War. I mean, there's no greater threat to individual freedom than having a central government that knows everything you're doing. I mean, that is the KGB, the Stasi, Gestapo, SS, the techniques that they have used down through time. This is nothing new. This is the kind of thing that totalitarian states have done from the beginning of time. So, I mean, you know, it's not a question of not recognizing what's happening. I mean, I had worked the Soviet Union for almost 30 years, and to me it was just outright obvious what they were doing when they started these programs. I mean, it was very clear to me from the very beginning that they were headed down this totalitarian path. And so I've viewed that all along as the greatest threat that our democracy faces. It's from within. And keep in mind, as I always point out, that the oath of office for everybody in Congress and the president and everybody else is to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. And that includes them if they are a part of the enemies of the Constitution. They need to reexamine what they're doing and why, and that they're violating their oath of office. That's the way I view that.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Although most Americans, I believe, are unaware of your truth that you just stated, that they're being spied upon, or at least having their personal data and emails and phone calls gathered and shared with people or corporations or government agencies that they know nothing of, few understand how this data can or cannot be used in a court of law, nor do they know about how information is intentionally laundered to indict people. Would you please explain the laundering of personal data, how it works, and including how it is used to arrest people? And then have you commented that the before on the primary use of NSA spying programs to assist law enforcement, which would contribute to the U.S. now being a police state that you just mentioned, and explain further this relationship between the NSA data surveillance and domestic law enforcement and its function in policing Americans in order to impose some kind of, I would say, fascist order upon the average citizenry?
Yes, I mean, that's, as a little background, you know, after the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union fell apart. There was in the... After 1990, I mean, NSA was looking around to find out who they could find as that would be a good customer So they needed a new customer for all their effort. So they had to look around, and it ended up that they thought they could use the terrorist program and international crime as a way to get to that and have a large customer set. That is, all the police forces in the United States and around the world, through the mutual law enforcement agreements and treaties, the MLAT program, where FBI and DEA cooperate through the diplomatic channels with the law enforcement around the world. So that was a very large customer set that they thought they could capture, and certainly to do that, you see, you had to collect all of the data in the world on everybody. That then gets down to the point where you're doing individuals, not groups of individuals who are involved in some terrorist act or governments or militaries and things like that, which was a much more focused problem. Instead, they had to have a general acquisition of information to satisfy the customer set of law enforcement. And that's what, Director Mueller of the FBI said in his interview with Bart Gellman in March of 2011 in Time magazine. He said they'd been using the Stellar Wind program since 2001. Well, the Stellar Wind program is the domestic spying program, pulling in all the emails, phone calls, recording phone calls, collecting and storing any kind of digital communications of U.S. citizens. That's simply the name of the domestic part of that. There's also a foreign part that covers all the rest of the people in the planet. So that was the whole point of them building an empire. That meant you had to have you had to build all these storage facilities, like the large one in Utah, to store all the data you're collecting. Then you had to put in place the capability to acquire the data as it was communicated. Now that means going down to fiber optic networks, and the main program they used to do that is Fairview. Fairview is basically AT&T, and they have on the order of 80 to 100 fiber optic taps inside the lower 48 states of the United States. If you go on Wikipedia and look for Fairview NSA, you'll find the slide that was released from the Snowden material that showed all the fiber optic taps inside the United States for them to collect data off the fiber networks. And that's why, with that bulk acquisition of information on U.S. citizens, that they had to build Bluffdale and other facilities. They opened up, they are building another one on Fort Meade, a 600,000-square-foot facility to store data. They broke ground for that last summer. and so now that's another one that they're building, and they have to build more. So in order to build an empire, and once you start acquiring the data, you got to build these storage facilities, then you have to build all kinds of communications to get the data there and back and get query the data from your analysts. You have to have contracts to manage the maintenance and communications of the network around the world to make sure people through X Key Score or IC Reach could get into those programs and pull out the data they wanted. So that made it how you build an empire and make yourself much bigger, and that's really what's been going on here. Instead of looking for efficiencies and solving the problem, they wanted to build an empire, and that was their objective. And so that's why I referred to them trading the security of the people of the United States and the rest of the free world for money to build this empire, which they currently have.
I have two interconnected issues. One is, recently I watched on Al Jazeera Ray McGovern in a debate with the head of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee. And McGovern said that, you know, you knew what they were doing. And the man said, yes, we all knew what they were doing. And you didn't come forward. And I've heard this from Jay Rockefeller. I've heard it in different times and different people on these committees. Now, when you take the total amount of senators and representatives on the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees, and you look at when was the last time any of them chose to come forward and say they are doing things that are illegal and against Constitution. Instead, they say, well, I'm prohibited from saying anything because we agreed that we wouldn't talk about it. And that now that it's all coming out, now that it's being exposed, I'm saying, Why don't we hold every single member of every one of those committees, House and Senate, responsible for their moral and fiduciary responsibility? They did not do what they were supposed to do. And there's also treaties that supersede our criminal court system that would protect them. If you see a crime, if you know a crime is being engaged in, you have a moral responsibility, a legal responsibility to address it. That's part of Nuremberg. So nothing do I see in the way of anything other than cowardliness on the part of our representatives and all the other people within the State Department, the Defense Department, who engaged cooperatively with each other in doing this over decades. Secondly, yes. Is what is the Special Operations Division within the federal government, and what is its function and what is its role in transitioning American democracy into a police state?
First of all, let me address the legality issue here. In the Executive Order 13526, Section 1.7, that's the executive order that governs classification for everyone in the United States government. Section 1.7 says you cannot classify, maintain classified, or not declassify material that is evidence of a crime, or material that's used to that is embarrassing to either an agency or a person. Or anything that is just in general illegal, like, for example, fraud, corruption, waste, and abuse. You cannot classify and maintain it classified. You have to declassify it, in fact. That's what that executive order says. And most of what they've been doing and keeping classified is, in fact, a violation of law or the Constitution. Now, what they've done over time, which is what totalitarian states have always done, is try to slowly and gradually manipulate the laws or the people to think that it is in fact legal for them to do what they're doing. That's what they did with the FISA Amendments Act, the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, and so on. It's to dupe the public into thinking they're doing something legal. And that's what the Nazis did in 1933 and 34, and that's what the Stalin did. That's what they all do. This is typical. If people read their history books, or maybe they don't read them anymore, this is very typical. And what they're doing with this material is using, for example, and Reuters reported this back in August of last year, that the Special Operations Division that was set up within the Drug Enforcement Administration was specifically tasked to look at NSA data to find criminal activity. And what they did with that then was they would use that material to pass to state and local law enforcement as tips to say, you know, go here and in this parking lot, wait for this person to pull in, and then go arrest them, and then bring the drug dogs in and find the drugs. And that's what they've been doing. And what happens after that is you see the material they used was from NSA acquired without a warrant, so it's not admissible in a court. So now they have to do a parallel construction. And that means that they use normal law enforcement techniques and investigative procedures to find the material. Of course, it always helps that they know where it is to begin with, so it makes them look really efficient, and they go find that material, and then they substitute that material for the NSA material in a court of law when they go to try these people. Well, I mean, that's a violation of their constitutional rights to challenge discovery of data against them in a court of law. And it's, in fact, subverting our entire judicial process. And they're not just doing it for us. They're doing it around the world, because everybody in the world, every police organization that has a relationship with the FBI or the DEA can experience getting this material, but have to do a parallel construction because they won't be given the original material because it came from NSA. So I've been calling this entire procedure, since I read about it last year, a planned programmed perjury policy run by the Department of Justice of the United States, because after all, that is perjury. If you or I did that, they would have us in jail in a minute. Well, I mean, this is our government and what they're doing. So, I think they're destroying our entire democracy from one end of it to the other. They're violating all the Constitution, and in fact, all the senators, if they wanted to, could stand up on the floor of the Senate and read all of this stuff out of these secret documents into the open record for people to understand what's happening. They cannot be charged with criminality for doing that. That's a part of their constitutional right. They could do that if they wanted to.
Well, I would like to see Elizabeth Warren go on the record at going after these people. I would like to see Bernie Sanders go on the record going after these people on these issues. They've gone on other issues, and I certainly respect that. I haven't seen them speak out on these issues that we're discussing. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, it's their constitutional duty to do that. It's their oath of office to do that.
It's very easy for someone to say we're against crime. Everyone is. You'll get a consensus.
Right.
We're against, you know, abuse of women. Everyone will say yes. But then be specific. Go after the CIA. Go after the FBI. If you really are there to serve the public, do that. It's easy to say you're going after Wall Street bankers, and we should, but that's an easy prey compared to going after these 17 different agencies and then subcontractors. And let's talk about that, because all told, there are estimated over 1 million people who are directly linked and work for national security operations, including thousands of private corporate contractors involved in intelligence operations who have little to meaningless oversight, and we don't know what they're doing with that. And also, why are we not seeing more whistleblowers? People such as yourself, Manning, Drake, Thomas Drake, Snowden, almost all, to me, are anomalies, because persons working with security clearance under great threats if they go public, or because the intelligence apparatus has been built upon a culture of fear. Could you address that, please?
Yeah, that's fundamentally what they're doing. Is they're going, anybody who is a whistleblower, they go after them as hard as they can. And the reason they do that is they want to keep everybody inside the government so afraid of doing anything that they'll just keep quiet. They want to silence any kind of opposition. This is typical, again, of totalitarian states. That's the way they do it. This is not a democracy in this sense. In the intelligence community and the spying mechanism inside our country, we have no democracy whatsoever. I mean, I'm waiting for them to come after me. So one time or other, they're going to do this. So, because I'm not going to be quiet. I mean, I'm not going to sit there like the Germans did in 1933 and 34 and be quiet, let everything happen and not stand up and speak against it. So I will not go into the darkness of Cheney without a fight.
Well,
so that's my whole perspective on that. I just will not participate in Cheney's darkness.
It's not just Cheney's darkness. You see, I have to separate out the responsibility of the average American, the responsibility of all of our religious leaders in all religions, to stop engaging in intentional neglect. If you wanted to know the truth about what is happening, you could find the truth. It is not a secret. Now, not to know that means you then don't have to share that with your congregation, because think of the power of informed and outraged congregations that their rights, their phones, their emails are being viewed, every one of them. The pastor, the imam, the rabbi, the priest, every single phone call, every single piece of this, why? Now you get them becoming awakened. Think of all the social organizations. Think of all the colleges in the United States. If you're bright enough to get a 4-point average at Harvard, you're also bright enough to know that you're living in a police state. But are you going to abrogate your responsibility in order to get that $200,000 starting job on Wall Street leading to $2 million? We live as if we are all smart until we're stupid. And I'm saying, let's stop playing this game. It's not Dick Cheney. It's not Bill O'Reilly. It's not Sean Hannity or the legions of the people who support this fascistic view on NPR, PBS, Fox, and other places, and MSNBC, because their corporate shills, whether it's left or right, is irrelevant. And then the average American then believes in what Rush Limbaugh says, and he's got 13 million listeners, or believes what a Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck says. So if they're inaccurate, if these people who are the beacons of supposedly the enlightened voice, if they're choosing not to be aware, then we're in trouble. So we're looking at a whole nation that has got to awaken to the problem, or you will be taken away along with others. And they won't care, they won't know, or they'll even be made to believe that you deserve to be taken away because you were a threat to real democracy. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, that's I agree with virtually everything you've just said. I mean, I put it on Cheney because Cheney was kind of the point of starting this. I mean, he was kind of the one to initially instigate this. So I focused back on him. But you could go back through history, back to Nixon. I mean, Nixon tried to do a very similar thing when he was president. But, I mean, he could only do so much. And at the time, the technology wasn't there to be able to support the massive scale of what's going on today. I mean, he only did an infinitesimal amount of what they're currently doing. And he was impeached for that, too. So I absolutely agree. But there's that tendency to go along to get along and it, within the system. So you kind of acquiesce to the power positions and the people in power to accept the kinds of things that they want done as probably the right thing. Maybe you don't know enough, you know, or maybe you just want to trust your government. Well, you cannot. Democracy is not something, it's not on trust. You have to verify and continue. It's an active thing. You can't simply sit back and acquiesce to things and hope that everything will work out. Democracy requires participation and active participation by everybody involved.
I absolutely agree. William, my last question for you. There are many critics and commentators scrutinizing the repressive policies during the Bush and Obama administrations, and they would say that the policing of and spying on Americans is all about money, power, and greed. Totalitarian regimes that you mentioned develop in order to protect certain interests and keep certain activities in strict secrecy, and the public and the international community is kept in the dark. What do you believe is the big secret the government wants most kept, and which, therefore, requires our extensive surveillance programs?
It's kind of hard. They're trying to do many, many things at once. And I think probably the idea of how closely they're tied with industry and how quickly or how many things they work and how much the intelligence community is becoming the driver of our government decision making is probably one of the things that they want to keep most secret. Simply because, who would want an intelligence? You can't trust these intelligence agencies. I mean, I worked in them, so I know you can't. I mean, the vast majority of people involved are good, hardworking, dedicated, patriotic people. But the core of the management gets corrupted at certain points, and they tend to think that they know better than anybody else, and so therefore they have to do what's necessary to protect the country, no matter what the cost. Whether it's internally causing our loss of our freedoms or whatever, they will do whatever it takes. Like they'll torture, they'll render people, they'll kill people, they'll drone them, they'll do double strikes, a double tap, killing just innocent people coming to help after the strikes. I mean, those kinds of things show you how the depth of the loss of moral code in what these intelligence agencies are willing to do and how they will execute them without objecting. And anybody who does object gets silenced in any way they possibly can do it. And that's why they can keep everybody in line, and that's a totalitarian state from beginning to end.
If you pull back, and I'm sure you have, in these years since you have been challenged for being a whistleblower, and you look at the larger picture, at some point you have to say, this is just insane. We don't need these massive, privatized, militarized corporate interests spying on Americans, because once they start, once one of these agencies gives contracts, it never ends the contract. Whatever amount they gave this year will only double or triple in the near future. Every one of these corporations that have the connections through their Defense Department or legislators, former legislators, current legislative aides, they're all connected in some way. They all get reciprocal profits in some way or benefits. And yet, if you ask, do we need all this? How much do we need to really be safe? You would find it's probably less than 10% of what we're spending, and yet the average American is excoriated if they suggest cutting a penny out of the National Defense and Intelligence Authorization budget. Shouldn't we be defunding these groups and closing down these companies in order to also have a chance of taking back our freedoms?
Yeah, I would say that that's absolutely essential. I mean, after all, it was Ronald Reagan who said there's nothing closer to immortality than a government program. So it's the same kind of thing. Once you start something, they like to keep it going ad infinitum because it's that builds an employment program and a budget and also an empire. So, yeah, we have to, in any way possible, defund these activities.
Well, that takes grassroots, and we would like to see power brokers, people who are retired CEOs who no longer have an allegiance. They've gotten their money, they put in their time. Now let them be free to come forward and address real issues, not just bottom line return for stockholders, but our freedoms. We need to stop hearing the contradiction of those who claim to be patriots on the right, but are not patriotic when it comes to defending our Constitution and Bill of Rights by stopping the military-industrial complex. There seems to be a great cognitive disconnect. But I thank you very much for all that you've done and the sacrifices you've made on behalf of all of us. We commend you for your courage.
Well, thank you.
Wim Binney, and a high-placed intelligence agent, one of the best and brightest at the National Security Agency for over 30 years. He had thousands of employees under him, and yet he saw how our national security mass surveillance program was illegal, unethical, and unconstitutional, and he had the courage to come forward and tell us. And as you heard him say, today we're no different than the KGB, the Stasi, the Gestapo, and he will not stay silent. They're going to come after him. They're going to go after Chris Hedges. Mark my words, every person who is an activist or an advocate will be targeted, has been targeted. It's just the opportunity for them to make that move. When the media has the American public so conditioned to believe that anyone who speaks out against anything the government or corporate America says is an enemy of the state, they'll know it's time. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a continuation of our special broadcast on America is a Postmodern Police State. In a moment, we're going back into the main studio to raise funds. This is a 8-hour special today. Hope you've been with us since 10 o'clock this morning and listening in and listening with Kathy Davis and Michael G. Haskins. And we're raising money today so we don't have to take a week to raise money, and we're hopeful that this will succeed. I also want to mention briefly that tonight the new feature documentary, which is qualifying for the Academy Awards, Poverty, Inc., will be showing at the Rosendale Theater on Main Street in Rosendale, New York. Now, that's 15 minutes New Paltz and Poughkeepsie, so I want to see the people living in Poughkeepsie and New Paltz go to it and Kingston and Woodstock. It's close by, and it's a public theater, so they're going to have the film, and then since I'm doing this all day, I'll be on Skype after it's over. And by the way, joining there in the theater live will be Gerald Salante, one of the most outspoken people in America on the corruption of our system, and he's in the film, and he'll be there live with a discussion following that. So Gerald Salante at the Rosendale Theater tonight. He's strong in the film, as is about 60 other major advocates. So you don't want to miss that. So you can call the theater for information. It's rosendaletheater.org, or the number is 845-658-8989, 845-658-8989, and I'll look forward to after the film is over. Now, tonight I'm doing a very powerful and important lecture. I'm mainly doing it to film it. It'll be released in the spring, Living an Intentional Life, how it's time that we all took back our life, took back the power to make the proper, healthy, positive, spiritual choices in our life. And it's going to be, it's all brand new. I've been writing the insights on it for about the last 6 months. And we have been full. We had one cancellation. If you'd like to come, call 646-926-5422. 646-926-5422. Now I'm going to turn it over to Michael G. Haskins, because I'm going to have to run from our studio where I broadcast from live and it's video streamed upstairs to my desk, because we have another program coming on live here, and so I can continue on up there. So for the next
we're looking
minute
forward
and a half
to that, Gary, and Gary will be joining us in just a matter of a couple of minutes. Kathy, let's just give the number out again. It's 212-209 2950. And we're talking about Fascism Incorporated, and we had to break into that program for that major policy shift in the United States and Cuba, the United States normalizing relations after 53 years with Cuba. So that's very, very interesting to see what happens. Sally O'Brien will be coming on at 2 o'clock with a brief update, a recap of the president's announcements and the policy shift. But we're going to continue now, right now, Kathy, as Gary comes back and joins us with this fundraising for WBAI at 212-209-2950.
That's right. And we have been covering a number of these premium offers that Gary has prepared, and they are incredible. We started out with Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State. And that's a pledge of $150 when you support WBAI. We also covered, well, we just got started on another offer, Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy. And that was a 4-CD program for your pledge of $100. So you can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And offer your pledge of support. And, you know, this is a full day of programming, but it's going to have a lot of information as we go through the remainder of today's special broadcast. So now would be the time, as we're making this transition, you can make your phone call, you can make your pledge of support, and then come back and enjoy the programming itself. 212-209-2950 is your number to call. Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State is a 10-CD set. History may repeat itself, but it never repeats itself identically. Since 9/11, George Bush's launch of the Patriot Act and Barack Obama's signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, the U.S. has rapidly turned its back on the principles of freedom, justice, and liberty engraved in the Constitution. Instead, in praise of militaristic domination, corporate greed, and power, and the myth of American exceptionalism, Washington has written a template for the emergence of a new fascism and a police state. And that's part of the introduction of the 10-CD set, Fascism, Inc., and it's only a pledge of $150 when you call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. If you can pledge at the $100 level, we will thank you with Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy. This four audio CD program offers interviews and conversations that you will be able to really take a really deep look, a really, really deep look at what's happening in the world today, really very relevant to what's been happening with the brutality of the police here in New York, in the New York area. And it offers exclusive interviews and conversations with some of America's most noted progressive civil rights attorneys, investigative journalists, and political scholars who have the courage to voice their opinion to unconstitutional policing of American citizens that is today transforming the U.S. into a militarized, totalitarian nation. And that's a $100 pledge for those four CD set when you call 212-209-2950. And you can pledge. We have a number of premiums that will be coming up as we go through the day. The Lords of Wealth, The Unseen Powers Behind America's Collapse. That's an $80 pledge of support. And also Intervention in the Name of Freedom, Peace, and Democracy, a 3-CD set, also an $80 pledge. But really, if you want to support the radio station and receive the full 20-CD set, that's a pledge of $250 to support WBAI. So you would be asking for Gary Null Special 20-CD set and includes Fascism, Inc., Lords of Wealth, Police State, Intervention in the Name of Freedom, Peace, and Democracy, four separate programs for that $250 pledge of support. For those of you who could pledge at the $150 level, it's Fascism Incorporated, How America Has Become a Police State. And that number again is 212-209-2950. And just before cutting to Barack Obama, we were sharing with you some excerpts from Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy, for a $100 pledge when you call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And remember, when you make that phone call, you are supporting WBAI Radio, but also you are supporting the decades of work being done by Dr. Gary Noe. And he offers many of his exclusive commentaries within these CD programs, as well as the in-depth interviews that he's provided with his many guests. 212-209-2950 is your number to call to show your support for WBAI. And as we're making this transition into bringing Gary back on live, he's going to be talking more about this special on fascism and the loss of our own dignity and our basic human rights here, right here in America. Very often we look to the world and say, point a finger at what's happening in various countries, but we're not paying attention to what's happening in our own front yard, our backyard, and on either side of us. We have a real assault on the rights of our own humanity. We have an assault on the rights of certainly there's racial-based activities that are taking place with regard to the police force and the stop and frisk and the willingness to use extreme violence against people of color, specifically and most specifically men of color. Black men are being really harmed in the streets by our police force. And there never seems to be a conviction. There never seems to be an accountability from the state for the violence that's being visited upon the people of this city. So that's why it's very important for you to support WBAI. 212-209-2950 is your number to call, and you have an opportunity to make that pledge right now for CD set, Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy. It's a $100 pledge of support. And earlier today we heard Fascism Incorporated, How America Has Become a Police State. It's a 10-CD set for your pledge of $150 when you call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950.
We're just taking a bit of a pause now to get these phones ringing, to get your calls of support to WBAI. You know, it's very important for people to understand that if we hadn't done this way, then we would have had to endure, and that's, I can use that word, a whole week of programming, a whole week of fundraising, I should say, a whole week of fundraising. And nobody wants to do that just before the holidays. Again, happy Hanukkah to everyone who observes. And we appreciate those of you who have called in thus far. And please do make your calls now. Consider WBAI with your end-of-year giving by making this call to WBAI at 212-209-2950. You can also pledge online at Give2. That's the number 2, the numeral 2, give2wbai.org. Just put in Gary Noe, the information will drop down. Drop-down menu is right there. You'll see where you can and how you can make a pledge to support WBAI. It's real simple. It's only going to take a matter of a couple of minutes, or you can make the call. Folks are standing by, ready to take your calls now at 212-209-2950.
That's right, 212-209-2950. Thank you, Michael G. And we have to really thank Gary Noe for all the work that he does on our behalf. I've seen this work take place over decades and decades of time, as far as, maybe I don't want to exaggerate the age, but it's such a beautiful thing to see the confrontation of the state power and to the pushback on the abuse that's taking place. And here we have an opportunity to really look at the worst of it. And the program we played for you going into that break was Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy. And I actually want to welcome back Gary Null to this extended program. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Kathy, and I'd like to welcome all of you who are listening. We're doing today's program special in order to bring in money that's really needed to the station so that we don't have to do an entire 7-day, 24/7 fund drive. And I wanted to do something that would tie us all together with what's happening in the nation, in the world, and that is where America's become a police state. We've all seen it. The listeners of BIR already know that. And we have two more segments of the program. We have more guests coming up, include the Lords of Wealth, the unseen power behind America's collapse, as well as Police State USA. We'll be talking in a little bit with Professor Norman Pollack. And he is an outspoken professor, long history of engaging in civil rights and anti-war activities over the decades. And so we're going to go to him in about 20 minutes. But we've been doing something that I believe a lot of people appreciate, and that is having an entire program without interruption, like our 10 to 11 program, where we had on so many good voices, Chris Hedges. And we also have coming up, you'll be able to hear from Glenn Greenwald. So we have some powerful voices to speak out on this. And we've done minimal pitching in between the programs or segments. There was the interruption that we didn't know about today, and we apologize for the interruption. But at noon, I went ahead and started with the head of Project Censored, the professor at California University, so that we could cover that in and hopefully heard William Binney give us some devastating insights about that we are, as he said, and he worked for 33 years for the National Security Agency, and he was one of the heads of it and founders of it. And he said it became clear to him that what we were doing was illegal. And he cited the executive order that says that if it's illegal, you don't have to protect it. So every member of Congress who was on all those Senate and House Intelligence Committees who knew the truth, but because of whatever motivated them, and I'm not going to assume I know their motivations, I don't, all I'll say is they all had a chance, from Jay Rockefeller and Nancy Pelosi and all the rest that served on those, they could have spoken up, and they didn't. Not once did they tell us the truth, knowing illegalities were occurring. So they could have also been protected not just by that executive order, but the Nuremberg Convention protects you also. So anyhow, we had that segment. We had Glenn Ford talking about the what really was behind the ghettoization of America and then the targeting of people of color because of that ghettoization, and then blaming them for the predicament we put them in. So we've had a lot of speakers, a lot of commentary. We started with a half-hour commentary that I did on America's police state, and we have a lot more to go, another 2 hours. So we thank you for being with us and for supporting the station. Now, we're going to do something a little different in the next 10 minutes here, Kathy.
Okay.
Because we want to offer just another type of premium also. In fact, today, a check for thousands of dollars is given to Berthold Reimers. We already gave the check for the premier. I turned the funds over, so that was good. And this is for something else that we've donated our time and energies to help the station. And that is we're doing a health retreat. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to be interested in this. So let me just explain this.
Okay.
You have seen in your own life the power of solitude and silence, reflection, detoxification, meditation, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I believe that a lot of people don't give themselves that opportunity. They just get on that grind every day, and they just keep doing what they do, not realizing the role of stress, the role of pollutants, the role of unhealthy diet. And so when I was asked by Berthold, would I raise some money for the station? And I said, I'll be happy to. Whatever you need, I will. And he said, could you do a retreat? And I said, okay, I've got a very busy schedule. I mean, like, when? And he said, well, how about after the first year? This goes back months ago. So I said, all right,
I will donate my time. I will not charge a penny for my time, and I'll get other people to donate their time, highly qualified people, and then we will do a retreat, as we have done successfully for people in this audience last year and the year before, because it raises money for the station, but the station doesn't have any expenses.
Mm.
So every dollar is a net dollar. And so it was successful, and the people loved it. It changed lives. So what we're doing is starting the second Sunday in January at a beautiful, one of the most beautiful places in America, where the weather is warm every day in the upper 70s or 80s, where you're going to have the day start with power walking under palm trees, and you're going to have meditation at the beach and yoga, Tai Chi, and deep breathing exercises. You're going to start with the most healthy smoothie you've ever had in your life. I just finished the recipe and gave it to our chief chef. We have four chefs, by the way.
Wow.
And these are all vegan, organic chefs, where in that smoothie you're getting the highest quality vegetable-based proteins from hemp and split pea and brown rice. You're getting essential fatty acids from coconut oil and flaxseed oil. You're getting berries like raspberries, blueberries, strawberries. You're getting mixes of green and red compounded vegetable and fruit proteins. You're getting coconut water. You're getting probiotics by the billions. And so this way, and a handful of walnuts or almonds and nut butters like chia butter and pumpkin seed butter. Now, you'd never make that smoothie for yourself. It'd cost about $25 if you did. It would. True.
I know.
But that's how you start your day.
Wow.
Then after that, every hour, we're asking you to have green vegetables to cleanse the system as a juice, and then red vegetables to rejuvenate. And then at noon or around 1 o'clock, you have this wonderful gourmet vegan meal. And we don't limit how much people eat, because they're going to lose weight, because it's rich living foods. It's beautiful presentation. We have cooking classes, raw food cooking classes, and juicing and detox. Then people who want to learn homesteading can learn about hydroponics, aquaponics, gardening for themselves in their apartment, their home, their balcony, their backyard, or even commercially, how to make a new business for yourself out of it, or how to start an urban garden, as people are doing around America today. In fact, I just posted on my website a garden in Brooklyn that's being done on a roof of a building where the restaurant's downstairs, and they're growing the food that they're serving upstairs on the roof. How about
wow,
that?
Wow, that's pretty cool.
That is cool as cool can be, and it's wonderful. And so we show people actually how to do that, because I'm an organic, certified organic farmer, and I'm a beekeeper. So I show you how to take care of bees and the power of honey, which they're now introducing bees into the urban environment, which is good for pollination.
Mm-hmm.
We show you also how to de-stress and how to do mindful meditation and how to feel comfortable in your own skin and how to live an authentic life that's your own life, not life you've mastered that was under the guidance or the control of someone else. And then every evening I do a lecture. Before my lecture, by the way, there is a light meal, a wonderful organic soup and a salad, and our salads are magnificent. You know, they're like 30 items in some of these salads, every kind of sprout and fresh-made salad dressings, and all the recipes, by the way, and every meal, every dish is different. We give all those to the people to take home with them, and then it's lights out around 10 o'clock. My lecture is generally from around 7 till 9, 9:30 or 10, and every day we repeat this. And people lose weight. It gives them a different perspective. They de-stress. You know, people benefit most, people who are stressed, depressed, anxious, overworked, underappreciated, and need some quality time to rebond with their essential and authentic self and to nature and little animals, little goats and sheep and llamas and
well, Gary, you realize you're speaking about everybody in New York City.
Well, not everybody would fit. Yes, they would benefit, but they won't all fit. And we want to limit it so that everyone gets personal attention. And by the way, everyone who chooses will have personal counseling. Lou Anne Panessi will be doing the counseling. And everybody will get counseled by Mitchell Rabin. You know Mitchell. He's wonderful as a therapist. And again, they're not paying extra for any of that. And normally, if you go away to one of these classy places and you get all that, you're paying anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000 for the week. Well, here you're only paying $2,000 because it's a fundraiser for WBAI and because all these wonderful people have donated their time. So when you're getting this at such a low fee, and I'm thinking, Amy does a good job of raising money for this station, and we commend her for that, and she asked $2,000 to have some fair trade coffee, watch her radio show, and have lunch. And that's good.
That's wonderful,
with that.
Yeah.
All right? Well, we're going to give you no coffee. We're going to give you about 12 hours a day of the most wonderful healing energy, exercising, personal exercising. No matter what your body or injury, you're going to be water aerobics. But John Q, you've met John Q, right? Wonderful human being. He's one of the best physio exercise specialists in America. Mm-hmm. He's going to be giving you water aerobics. I'm going to be on the road power biking with people who've never power biked in the gym. So everybody gets personal attention. Everybody is in a beautiful environment. Everybody can de-stress. You're close to nature. You're bonding. You're releasing toxins. You understand how to release negative energy from the past, how to forgive the past, how to get present, start the new year empowered, starting the new year on a positive foot. And that's all it is. And this is a fundraiser for WBAI. And we could not possibly afford to do this if I charge what I normally charge for my time. And but that's how I'm able to, you know, do as much charity work, including for the station and, mm-hmm. and all free counseling as I've done throughout my career. Because when I lecture and I do a retreat, as I just did in California, you know, they pay, you know, they pay the dollars, allow me to do the other things for free. So when I'm and everyone else is supporting the station, then we can charge a little bit of money. Because where else in America, do the math, where else could you get gourmet organic meals served, juices all day long, 10 juices, 15 juices, however many you want, a protein smoothie in the morning that would cost you $20 for just that one, you can have as many of that day as you want, personal counseling from people that would normally charge you $500 a session, you're getting it for free, being able to have a wonderful night's sleep. If you just stayed at a regular hotel, not a big one, just a little one, that's $100 a night. In season, are you kidding? In season, in the wintertime, in a southern climate,
mm-hmm.
then you talk about your meal. You're already over what you would pay. So this, there's nothing, no deal like this. So if you can afford it, make it happen. And there we have room for two people the first week, and we have room for three people the second week. And for those who are absolutely stressed to the max, we do have what is called a work study. And we have room for two work study. Those are people who come and can take the classes, but they also have to put in some work to help. Might help in the kitchen, might help serving the food for lunch and dinner, might help cleaning up. Simple things, easy to do. So we have, and that's $1,000 for the work study, but it's $2,000 for the regular people coming who don't have to do anything except detox, rejuvenate, get themselves rebalanced emotionally, get focused, get positive, get rid of the negative energy in your life. No more depression, no more anxiety, no more fear. And that's our goal, to help people on that journey of healing. Now, you've seen people who've been through that process.
That's right.
You know what's possible. And all they have to do, let me give them the number to call. They're going to call. Let me see what number. Let them call. What number? I don't have the number. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to ask them for the number. Hold on.
Okay. So this is really a wonderful retreat. I haven't been to one of these retreats in a very long time, but it is an amazing experience, and I know that you will enjoy it. And the truth be told, $2,000 for the whole retreat. In many of these spas, these health spas, you would be spending $2,000 a day.
That's
rather
correct.
Than for the whole retreat. Yes, do you have the number?
Yeah, I will in a second.
Okay.
And they're very impersonal at these peaks. I've gone to all of them. I wanted to see what are they offering. I've gone to where there are, up in Canada, four people to a room and no bathroom in the room. One in Arizona, four people to a room. You have to walk 5 minutes to a bathroom. They give you no special juices. You get no counseling. You have to pay $6,000 to counsel the physician. This is true. You can look it up on the internet. So you walk out of there with $13,000. Now, you may be healthier, absolutely, mm-hmm. and I believe he gives good information. I respect the man's work. But it's a lot of money. So, and go to La Costa, go to some of the big places, the $100 million resorts. To me, it's very impersonal. There's everything is faux finished. There's nothing natural. You're not really in a real natural environment. And there's too crowded. So here it's very personal. It's a small number of people. Everybody gets personal attention. And we just ask people to keep it positive. Now,
I think Luann is on the line. Is Luann Panessi on the
Luann's
line?
Luann's here.
Is she on the line with us?
Yeah, let's say hello to Luann.
Yeah, hello. Yeah.
Luann, yes. By the way, Kathy, do you have one of the tapes of some of the people who are commenting about the last retreat we did for the BAI?
Yes, I do believe we have some of those commentaries. I don't know if they're right up ready to go.
Let me give you the number. Uh-huh. He'll get it ready in a second. Here's the number to join us. I'm going to be there, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And give your name and phone number. If it's busy, please be patient. And Luann will call you back because she screens people because we want to know that a person's expectations are within the realm of reasonableness for what we're offering. And that this way you have a really good opportunity to be helped being there. And especially if you're stressed. And also, we're going to get hit with that winter vortex again in January. And so you're going to be in a nice, warm climate, rejuvenating, starting your new year with new resolutions, a new mindset, new cleansing and detoxification. It's the retreat that you don't want to pass up because it's the only one. My schedule is packed. I made a big sacrifice, take 2 weeks out of my schedule. If you saw my schedule, I just signed a new contract for 6 new books on self-empowerment and spiritual issues, and I'm taking 3 months to write these. And I'm sequestering myself, but I took time out first for helping our wonderful station BAI to do this. So call 877-627-5065. And Kathy, do we have those testimonies before we go to Luann?
No, I don't think that they're up quite yet. The computer seems to be a little bit stuck for some reason, but we'll have it down in just a second.
Okay, well, let's go over to Luann. Luann, what would you like to add, please?
Well, Gary, I've been at so many of the retreats, and the most beautiful thing for me is to watch people come down. They're all stressed out. They're traveling. They're just gone through the holidays, and they land at the retreat, and they're surrounded by beautiful birds, exotic birds, walking around, and there are animals. And when people suddenly settle in, and they're there, and they start to connect with nature, and they start to connect with the animals. There's something magical that happens. And, I mean, we've had people that, you know, I got to tell you this. Some of these people, their colons are all clogged up. They've had horrible diets, and now all of a sudden they're having healthy foods, healthy juices, and they get more excited about the fact that their colon is cleansed more than anything. It's pretty amazing. It's just one of the most life-changing experiences that someone can have. And I know when I came down there the first time, I didn't know what to do with myself at first. I wasn't used to being quiet. There's so much chatter that goes on in our lives. And this was an opportunity for me to actually sit down in nature with the amazing water features and the beautiful exotic plants and fruit trees right on the track. You're power walking and there's fruit trees right there. And it's amazing how nature can heal you. And there are like 15 different meditation gardens with all different themes that you could just sit in all day and just reflect and relax. And, boy, do we need that. We have an overstressed society. So,
and I think we have a couple of those testimonials ready if you want play a couple of those.
Let's hear
that.
From BAI, who actually attended the last one.
Okay.
to say that this has to be one of the most bucolic, one of the most healing environments I've ever been in. And here is a place where I am, probably for the first time in my life, connecting with nature like I never have before. And there's a sense of relaxation and a sense of bliss that I didn't know that I could even experience. And I'm watching other people go through this in their own way. And while all this is going on, I'm enjoying whole live organic foods. There's no meat, no dairy, no sugar, no processed foods, but instead we're getting whole live foods prepared in a way that I never had before. We are getting some of the most delicious gourmet vegan meals that have been prepared by these specialty chefs, and mouth-watering, delicious meals that are satisfying. We're outdoors and exercising every morning, walking, all of us in one big group, power walking outside as the sun is coming up. And then we're doing yoga right on the most beautiful lake with swans, and while we're doing the yoga. It's just, quite frankly, nothing like I've ever experienced before. It is just one of the most amazing experiences of my life, and I'm so grateful and so thankful to have been here.
I have come down here under a very stressful time, and I have forgotten about all my stress. It's like stepping into a magical place that I've never knew existed here. It's tranquil. It's on everyone's faces. It's bliss. All working together, the energy of all these people here. It's an amazing thing. No one's lazy, yet it's effortless. I just recommend this so highly, and you will see you're feeling the same way as me.
I have gone to other retreats before, but I have always enjoyed Gary's the most. There is so much to offer in beauty and different things to do. I, for the first time, have enjoyed yoga because he has an excellent teacher here. It's just a wonderful, peaceful place to be. The food is fabulous. There's a lot of lessons to learn here. A lot of things to help open you up.
I think the most important thing that where I've changed what I've learned is that, going on the nutritional vegan diet turned out to be much easier than I thought, because I was used to a pretty heavy dose of coffee in the morning, a regular wine drinker, and I've discovered that I really don't miss those things, so it was much easier for me than I ever anticipated that it would be. So I expect to leave here and implement the knowledge that I've obtained.
One of the most advantageous things we do here at the Villa is each morning we get up and we do some power walking out in nature as the sun is coming up, looking over fields of horses and their colts and beautiful cows and other wildlife that are out there, the birds. And it's a different way of exercising than just getting on a treadmill. And you just lose yourself to the whole experience. And you don't even feel like you're huffing and puffing. You're just breathing easily and flowing with everything that's around you. And I consider myself an athlete. And for me to be able to work out so effortlessly is a magnificent experience. And as well, we have people doing personal counseling that can help you work through your issues and help you to be a stronger human being on every level. You feel real difference in every aspect of your mind, your body, your environment, and your well-being. And it's the greatest place to be, and everyone should experience it.
In one level, it's really people getting out of the city and coming to the country, up to the country. And in another more subtle way, it's getting out of the noise that is in our head, the noise of the city, the noise of our busy brain, and coming essentially to the silence. And in the silence, I think that answers are there. And combine silence with beauty. And I think beauty provides a door or window to the invisible world that is within us. and then a lot of things become clear. There's a lot of focus. We have it all kind of within us. We have here the tools to try on and then incorporate into our lives.
I have gained so much from this retreat. It's been an absolutely fantastic experience. My fears, anxieties, and frustrations, I'm able to leave them behind with a group of people who are working together to simplify our lives and look clearly at the troubles that we're going to be facing in the future with limited resources. And we have been eating the best food you could ever imagine, getting healthy, exercising, and learning how to care for one another. And it's an experience I think everybody can benefit from. I highly recommend that you think about it and hopefully commit yourself to a week of healthy living so that we can prepare for our future, because we're going to have a lot of very, very serious demands placed upon us.
Well, this retreat, I had a wonderful experience, something that I wasn't even thinking about. All I came here for is a power walking and the water aerobics, but many other things, especially food, and I experienced a closer, more quietness and appreciation for nature. Thank you very much, Garinal. This was very interesting.
I came down here with a lot of medical issues and stuff, and I couldn't wait to get here. I've heard a lot about it, and I've listened to Gary for quite some time. When I've been an outdoors person and love plants, I had an unbelievable experience to see some specimen trees and plants here where I could lose myself and really get back to nature. The food here, if you've never had real vegan food, this is a whole different experience. It's not boring and bland. It's some of the best food I've ever had in my life. As for the lectures, those will be with me for the rest of my life. I've learned an awful lot, and I hope to use all the experiences I've had here for the better of my future. It was unbelievable. I'll never forget it. And I want to thank Gary and his staff for all their compassion and their help. It means the world to me.
This experience of the week with Gary Noel has been for me, it's been life-altering. I came here with really no direction at all, really shut down. And now I've seen with this beautiful setting, with the opportunity to really re-examine my life in full, and like never before. So I'm just so happy that I've come here, and look forward to the rest of my life. And I have Gary Noel to really thank for that, that he has this available for folks. And, you know, I would recommend it any time.
This experience has really changed me for the better in the last 5 days. I never realized how much I could have self-reflection and just relax, being present in the moment. Living in the hectic life that most of us live in, getting to step away from that and just to, like I said, be present has been really amazing, calming, and just a wonderful experience that I hope to continue once I leave here and work on in my everyday life.
This experience this week is meant, to me, it's meant getting in touch with myself in a truer sense. Being in a very lush, green environment. I've had a wonderful time with the new people I've met, with the wonderful food I've been eating, all the juices I've been drinking. It's just been a way of getting back in touch with the true self, not the self that's being led to believe is what is ourself. And, hey, it's just a wonderful experience. You got to check it out.
Coming to Gary's retreat was the most amazing thing in my life. I belong to a gym, but, you know, you never really learn about the equipment and how your body works and how it affects you. He has expert staff here that teaches you how to use the equipment. And I'm a good cook, and I love to cook, but I learned all about different foods and how to put them together. And it was just a beautiful experience. I'm a big nature lover, and staying here was gorgeous. I would recommend it to anybody that would really want to learn about their inner selves, and let go of their fears and anxieties, and learn to be one with nature.
One with nature. Wow, that's really incredible.
Yes.
And
all walks of life, all ages. One guy was almost 90. One was 20. All backgrounds, ethnicities, religious beliefs, but they all came for one reason. They all wanted to get healthier, live a longer and happier life. That's the goal. So we're doing this as a fundraiser for this great station. It is ideally 2 weeks, but if you can only come 1 week, we have two places in the first week and two places in the second week. But ideally for two, call this number, and you'll be given a call back by Luann Panessi, who will be there in counseling. The number is 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. And, Kathy, that's it on this. We're going to go to our guest as soon as I'm told that we have him online and go back to our regular programming.
Okay, so as I'm going to just remind people about some of the offers, and then that'll give Reggie a chance to make that connection for you.
Excellent.
So I just want to remind folks that you are listening to a special extended program for Gary Noll, and it's featuring really how America has become a police state. One of the offers that we have been giving you, have been sharing with you, is Fascism, Inc. And this is a 10 CD program. And we're asking for your pledge of $150 for this 10 CD program. It includes several of the commentary hours of Gary Noll. It has Professor Sheldon Wolin on the myth of American democracy, Professor John Galtung, and he is wrote about the fall of the American empire and we will decline into a neo-fascist state, Chris Hedges, Professor Norman Pollack, Professor Andrew Colin, Ray McGovern, Henry Giroux. And so it's chock full of actual information that tells you, that documents how this fascism has occurred in America. How did we get to where we are today? And it's important to know that, because we have to unravel this mess. We have to come together and unravel the mess that was created. Fascism, Inc., How America Has Become a Police State, for your pledge of $150 to support WBAI. And we also offered, we touched upon another of our programs, Police State USA, The Shredding of American Democracy. And that's a pledge of $100 for that CD set. And it's four audio CDs that offers exclusive interviews and conversations with some of America's most noted progressive civil rights attorneys, investigative journalists, and political scholars. The number to call is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. And Gary, your guest is ready for you to introduce. The number is 212-209-2950. Go ahead, Gary, yes.
Kathy, let's put this in perspective. Mm-hmm. With the exception of that little extended premium offer just now, we have had very little pitching today. It's almost always been content. And when they call the station and get the whole package, which is over 20 different CDs, 10 hours on Fascism, Inc., 4 hours on Police State USA, 4 hours on, 3 hours on The Lords of Wealth, The Unseen Power Behind America's Collapse. I wanted to do that because you know how many times you've heard people say, oh, it's the bankers, oh, it's the Rothschilds, oh, it's the Illuminati. Well, in point of fact, it's not. When we spent a year investigating this in depth, we actually were able to find the 147 companies in the United States and around the world that control 40% of the total wealth in the world. Now, that's a very few companies with enormous clout, and very few of those are known to the world public. Then what do they do with that wealth? What other companies do they buy? And so we wanted to show you who really are the manipulators. Who are the people who are really behind the scenes? So then we have the Lords of Wealth. Then we have a five-hour series that I did called Intervention, where I took a look at the history of our intervening in the name of peace, freedom, and democracy in Guatemala, in Cuba, in the Philippines, in Europe, in Africa, and how in every single case that intervention really did not serve any interests of true democracy or freedom. It served special interest groups, and that's fully documented. So all of these together, you're getting for only $250, and that is a phenomenal bargain. So you get the whole set, everything, for the station, and it goes right out to you. One number, one more time on that, please.
212-209-2950, and the whole 20-CD set is a $250 pledge of support to WBAI. It's like a massive, massive amount of information.
Thank you, Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, our last mention for the health retreat, second week of January, is right now the number is 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Now, for those of you who are just joining us, I'm Gary Nall, and this is a special broadcast on America as a Postmodern Police State. My guest from East Lansing, Michigan, is Professor Norman Pollack. Professor Pollack is a professor emeritus of history at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. He has a long and distinguished history of engaging in civil rights and anti-war activities over the decades. And he has been around for a long time. In fact, when he was very young, he was in the campaign for Henry Wallace and his Progressive Party in 1948. Later, he campaigned for Adlai Stevenson in the 50s in support of Martin Luther King. He's a two-time Guggenheim Fellow. He is a major intellectual voice during the late 60s in giving a knowledgeable boost to the New Left and writing on American populism, which became a popular documentary, The Populist Mind. After receiving his doctorate in American civilization from Harvard University, he taught at Yale University and Wayne State before going to Michigan. In his later years, he has focused on the history of civil disobedience and social political alienation and the sociology of fascism. He currently writes for Counterpunch, looking at the identifying characteristics of America's descent into a new form of neoliberal fascist state. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Pollack.
It is wonderful to be here, Gary, I won't say in rapture, but just listening to your summary of the CD program that you've worked out, it's just terrific. And so I'm glad to be here, and I'm not sure what you'd like to talk about. I've jotted a few things down.
I was just noticing today that on our archives we posted a photograph showing a Japanese convicted person who was convicted for waterboarding being hanged by America, and I think it's rather insightful that what we considered a war crime punishable by death today, you have an enormous section of the American population, including a lot of the religious right, who believes in waterboarding, believes in what they call intense interrogation was acceptable, and a lot of the media and a lot of politicians are fearful of actually saying this is illegal and the people engaged should be prosecuted. There shouldn't be two sets of laws. One, if you're a citizen, and everyone else, where you could be arrested for jaywalking, you could be arrested for standing in front of your own home on a street. If you're a homeless veteran, you can be arrested for sitting in a veteran's park. True story. I interviewed the man who was. And where the return of 27 states now have debtors' prisons, over 68 communities now make it illegal to feed or house the homeless in a community. So I think that we had better have a moment of clarity in our society to look honestly and not through the lens of an ideology, but through the lens of universal truth and say, if it was a war crime punishable by death, and I'm opposed to the death penalty personally, but if it was punishable by death to the Japanese, why should we
not hold the people who engaged in these and who protected them, who advised them, who counseled them, the psychologist, and who tried to legalize it, the people in the Justice Department, why shouldn't we hold them accountable as well?
Gary, just by chance, yesterday I started off at 2 in the morning and just sat there for 12 straight hours and wrote something originally titled Brothers in Arms, Partners in Infamy, subtitled Obama and Brennan, and it appeared today in Counterpunch, under the title of Obama and Brennan, and then the subtitle. And what you're saying, it's when you look at any of those aspects, of, for example, those two psychologists who had absolutely no background for anything and who legitimated the cruelest, harshest forms of torture and walked away with $81 million for their consultantship, which is not the important thing, of course. But the extent to which that unfortunately, it was completed in 2012, but the Senate report on torture, which has been stalled to this day in terms of the larger report and the redactions, is so great. And in all of this, we see Brennan, as director of CIA, attacking the Senate committee, denying the torture. And what's much worse than all of that is Obama serenely justifying Brennan and saying he is a patriot, we are solidly for him, and so on. And when you, the little bit that we've got from this that has come out on the Senate report, Zubaydah, Abu Zubaydah, for example, I quote a little bit in the article today. Here's a guy who was tortured, waterboarded so much, and where he became transmogrified, bubbles coming out of his mouth, that finally, after weeks of this, he is led into the room, and he dutifully just adopts the position. Then the person who, the jailer, the punisher who is doing this, simply has to raise an eyebrow and make two clicks of the finger, and that's the cue for him to submit. He has become so dehumanized, so destroyed, his identity so shattered, and this is what we want. And I'm sorry, it's more than, and of course you know this too, of course you know this, it's more than just a double standard where we're applying punishment or law to one and not to another and overlooking whatever we want. When we look at even all of the torture, and you look at the Department of Justice and that Office of Legal Counsel, what they do is they shape the law in order to specifically justify or legitimize that particular form of torture, so that the standard line now is, well, we did nothing wrong. We did nothing wrong because we followed instructions. This is very much like Eichmann. We followed instructions. We were assured by the Justice Department that everything we did was legal and within the boundaries of their instructions. And so those boundaries are written up. One before was John Hough, Y-O-O, who went back to Berkeley, who really pretty well set up a whole catalog of acceptable practice, and for us now, it's really very sad. I mean, obviously very sad. If we ever would be able to have a true Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as some countries which have known torture, and I believe Brazil is one of them now. Because the president of Brazil was herself tortured under the military dictatorship. And so we'll never get the full thing. And, of course, we will not get the full thing because of all the redactions. It turns out that in that full report, 15% of the report itself has been redacted, blacked out. All of those things that would be incriminating. Why do you redact? You redact in order to shield people from war crimes, so that they're right. It got to the point where CIA agents were in the report, pseudonyms were used for them, and even the pseudonyms had to be redacted or changed to still further pseudonyms. It smacks very much. Not only smacks, it demonstrates that we're pretty close to a totalitarian society.
I appreciate those insights. When in our laws does it, where in our laws does it permit the federal government and our intelligence agencies, such as the CIA and the National Security Agency, to conduct surveillance on our phones, communications, emails, and directly spy on innocent citizens?
Right, Gary. Richard sent me that question, and my first reaction was simply, I don't have the legal training, I don't know the specific laws, but as I think of it now as we talk, it doesn't matter, because so much of this is done through either very vaguely crafted legislation, which authorizes, you know, just as we have with that FISA court, and there's such an element of arbitrariness that there is not respect for the law. There's not respect for the rule of law. And so either things are done as, for example, you know, when we ask this, not apply to our own citizens, but to those we classify as enemies, you have rendition. Rendition takes you out of the ballgame altogether. There are no laws. You go to a black site in another country, you pay off, as has been shown, I believe, in this Senate report, you pay off the rulers of those countries and they supply, it's like a rent-a-torturer. You can use one of theirs, or you can have your own people. And Poland was one. Thailand was another. There are a bunch of places that had a kind of almost like a cottage industry of American torture. So what happens in terms of our own case, I guess my feeling, and just from my limited experience of knowing about things and so on, is that instead of torture, you just ruin a person's life. You ruin a person's reputation. We saw that most obviously or vividly with the Hollywood 10. But I can remember as a kid and as a teenager, if I was visiting in Washington, I would sit in on some of these hearings, and they were unbelievable. You break the person. In fact, this happened very, very close to home when I was a freshman at the University of Florida, where we had a professor of ancient history from a Republican family in Pennsylvania, and I'm not trying to doctor this or slant it, a very gentle person who at Harvard before the war had been a member of the Teachers College Union. The Teachers College Union after the war was pronounced to have been communist. He goes to Washington. He's called before the Un-American Activities Committee. He comes back on the train, stops in Gainesville, stops in Jacksonville, gets the paper. Across the front page of the Jacksonville Times Union, a big headline, so-and-so fired from the University of Florida. Fired, why? Because he was called. And from then on, he became luckily he had independent funds for a while, but his children were ridiculed in school. This was so typical. And that kind of social dimension to the Cold War really hasn't gone away. It may have become muted and forgotten when things appear to be a little more genial. But there is a level of repression that is so important because it doesn't have to be a concentration camp. It doesn't have to flex muscle or show guns. It's something that is internalized. You learn to know how far you can speak, what you can do and say. There, a very distinguished historian, when I passed my generals, the doctoral exams, this is maybe around 1959 or 60 or something, he came to our little party celebration. This is Isaac Deutscher, who had written biographies of Stalin and Trotsky and Lenin and so on. And he many of the collections at Harvard. And he said to me that when he had been there before, several years before, which would have been the earlier 50s, things were such and such. There were tents. People were suspicious. You don't even look at the Stalin papers, even if you're a scholar, and so on. And he said, now being 59 and later, things seem so much better. And then he said, but you know, they're not. What's happened is that repression has become so pervasive and so internalized. So it really is something to speak out. I don't know what can't. Sure, well, go ahead, Gary. I'm sorry, I'm talking so much.
I think most people could appreciate that we do need a certain level of security, selective surveillance, such as targeting known extremist groups and those that are real terrorists. However, the implications change dramatically when surveillance becomes universal for all citizens rather than select individuals. What do you feel are the major implications of universal surveillance?
A marvelous question, seriously. And my own sense, I guess two things come to mind right away. One is that the selective surveillance is part, sure, it's necessary, just as the apprehension and punishment of real criminal conduct is necessary. But my sense is that what passes for selective surveillance is itself a pretext for enlarging the scope of surveillance, because the society appears to require that degree of social control. The word that is unfortunately, it's a little too strong, so I can't quite find what I'm looking for. But the word that comes to mind here is regimentation, and the regimentation again is that sense in which, if it is possible to break down the identity of the individual, break it down enough so that the individual is still a useful citizen and so on, but heaven forbid speak of class, heaven forbid criticize military activity. The very concept of the citizen requires a degree of conformity and acquiescence, so that I think it would be a cheap trick if anyone were to take the bona fide security needs and use that to then silence criticism of the enlargement of the pool, of the scope, to what, you're right, it is universal now. And so by being universal, it means that people think a little bit twice. Do I say what I'm saying on the phone? Do I say in my emails what I would like to say? So here, I'll put a little cosmetics in. I'll doctor it up a little bit. I'll be softer, more gentle, even if what I'm criticizing has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or terrorism or anything else. It might even be, gee, I thought that baseball team really screwed up. I mean, you get to the point where you're diverted from that kind of substantive way of thinking.
How is all the personal data from collecting emails and phone conversations and history of the internet use, a person's buying and traveling habits, being used by the federal government and police agencies, and for what purpose? Now, I read an article that they're also bringing in psychologists or behavioralists
to look at people's personal data and then try to create psychological profiles. And also, adding to what you just said, is not true that, let's say you had a conversation with someone, you had an argument with someone, let's say that you were making a joke or you had an inappropriate comment that you made over the phone. They now have that. Everyone says something in private that they'd rather not have the world know at different times in life. No one is a saint, and now all that is there. What if you're a person and you are sharing your fantasies? Now they have that information, and we already know from many records from the Freedom of Information Act that the National Spy Agency and the CIA spied on foreign companies that were competitors of American companies, gave that information to American companies. Now, no one went to jail, and they should have, and yet they used it purely to help special groups. What in the world do you think they could do if they had the average person's full information and then created a psychological profile?
Okay, two parts that I just want to mention. One, I think that for most people, spying on foreign competitors, foreign business, and then giving the results to America, to American business, would be regarded as a very good thing. I don't think they would see this as criminal at all. So this would be something. The you used a word, Gary, that I think is the most important thing here. You used the word private, and what I believe we are seeing, and it doesn't explain anything, it just describes it. What we are seeing is such an invasion or destruction of privacy, and privacy as, at least as I would, and I hope others would feel, privacy is not only essential, but is the essence of the individual. This is what makes us distinctive as human beings. Our ability to be able to think and to have that kind of space that is free from coercion and free from even if I can to go along with them to sort of go with your thought, free from exposure. Who has the right to expose the fantasies of another if by doing so one really cripples, undermines that person's whole being? We're supposed to be a nation, partly at least, not partly, but we're supposed to be a nation of dreamers. But dreaming is a freedom or a manifestation that is outside the realm of social control. At least it is until something comes along where even dreams become regulated and controlled. So sure, you've asked a question that exposes. Don't want to use that again, but that really reveals what is at the heart of the breakdown of our society, if not of our whole civilization. Privacy should be cherished. It should be non-ideological. Libertarians should respect it as much as radicals. Everyone should respect it as a concept of what the human being is made of. And it shows how much we're running roughshod over the most basic kinds of things that constitute the individual.
Are there examples you know or can share with us that show the insidious manner in which government spying occurs outside the security matters? For example, we know, as we just discussed, this case of CIA and National Security Agency spying on foreign corporate competitors. You said that would not be, considered a bad thing. There's the famous Siemens case in Germany regarding this.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the government spies on behalf of companies like Monsanto when nonprofit organizations are about to release research and data showing the adverse effects and failures of genetically modified crops. So if you look at the individuals who are being spied upon because they work at the CDC, Dr. Thompson, and he discovered that information they were giving on vaccines, especially to young African-American children, were wrong, and that there was a very high incidence of abnormalities that could be classified as autistic, and they lied about the data. They changed it. Now, he knew about that. So now we're told by William Binney today, who was on before you, that virtually all governmental agency employees are spied upon because the government doesn't want anyone working for the government, directly or indirectly, to have any information that could embarrass anyone in the government. So now, if you would like to be a whistleblower, because I ask him, why are there so few whistleblowers when you have over 2 million people involved in the national security state, not just through the 17 agencies, but also through the thousands of private corporations, and then they are handling all this information. You have people who are reading your emails, looking at photographs that you share, who know all about you. You don't even know they exist, and yet they have profiled you, and what they do with that information is up to them. And there's no science behind any of this. So I'm very concerned that we will not see a new group of whistleblowers because of the punishment inflicted on the existing whistleblowers. This president has punished more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917 than all other former presidents of the United States combined.
Yes.
And yet his base has not challenged him on this. The corporate liberal community has not challenged him on this. You know, he still gets a free pass on everything. Your thoughts?
Right. No, definitely. This is not outside. This is not spying outside of surveillance that we're talking about. But within the last week, at least in terms of our general knowledge, what has become the great example of what you're talking about? And what it is, of course, is the revelation, and I guess it's been known for quite a while, but not really broadcast, discussed for, until now, the revelation that the CIA is spying on the Senate committee that is investigating it. Not investigating it, but providing oversight of it. And that this is such a monstrous, gross violation of the separation of powers, there are no limits. And when Obama then praises Brennan, who takes off on the committee, that the CIA actually wanted the Justice Department to prosecute the Senate committee because it had gotten into some of the CIA's own inner documents. And in my piece today, one thing I raise simply is, how can an agency of the executive an agency of the government keep secret from its oversight committee these documents, and then even try to bring suit against them because they want them? It sounds a little tricky, but basically in all of this, Obama not simply looks the other way, not simply smiles and lets Brennan, as in this case, lets Brennan carry the ball on the attack on the committee, but he goes about praising them, and he calls these people patriots over and over. That was the operative term in the last 3 or 4 days in press conferences and in statements and so on. Brennan is a patriot. The guys who have had such a hard time in doing the torture, and they're not calling it torture, as you say, enhanced interrogation. They should be pitied. They're the real patriots because they work so hard. It's mind-boggling, and as you say, the whole liberal and other whatever the community whatever term we want to use has given Obama a free pass, and has, by virtue of all of that, even allowed him to accelerate these processes. So when you say he has used the Espionage Act more than all other presidents combined, this is the fruit of that. This is that open space that, I guess it's like a broken sealed runner. if you knock out all the guards, all of the possible tacklers, you've got a free route to the goal line, and that consists of all kinds of exercises and suppression and repression and intervention and so on. So it's what I'm trying to say, Gary, is that you can take, and this is what I wanted to say, you can take specific things, whatever you're working on, and it's terribly important not to rest with just the specific, but try to work out the interaction between the specific and the larger context, between the specific and the general, because that specific, if you bear down hard enough, and we're speaking now, for example, of the existence of torture, or we're speaking now of drone assassination, the armed drones, or whatever it is we're speaking of, for that to even happen requires an entire institutional structure that allows it to happen. So that it's so important to make that kind of interaction between the most, whatever you want to call it, some things quite prosaic, but simply those things that are details, if you will, and then try to work your way into the larger context that made those details even possible.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I want to share with you a conversation with a person who I don't know who he is. He never gave his name, but it was when I was in Washington, D.C., and I was lecturing as a fundraiser for our sister station, WPFW, and it was at the Civic Center there, and it was packed. And afterwards, and I was there 7 hours. It was a long day.
Wow.
And afterwards, this gentleman came up to me, and he said, could I share a moment with you? And it's not about a health question. I said, sure. And he said, I listen to you all the time. A lot of us in my office listen. And I said, yes. And he said, what I'm about to tell you may seem impossible, but I'm telling you the truth. He said, here's how it really works. You work in Washington, and everyone is a great white shark looking for a nosebleed.
Oh,
and he said, if you work for a legislator, you work your way up, and what you do is outside of the office, every night, you're being groomed by special interest. You're being wined and dined, and these are all very quiet. There's no log where anyone's name. You don't put anything on your computer. We're all smarter than that. But let me give you an example, he said. Let's say that this morning I have a racquetball meeting, and on playing racquetball at 6 to 7 a.m. this morning, we also discuss a particular piece of legislation that should be put in front of a legislator to get his endorsement. The legislator is too busy raising money and being a politician to actually read and have any authority on these special issues. So we do the talking points. We, the chiefs of staff, we're the ones who present him with, these are the bills you should support, these are the ones you shouldn't, these are the people you should allow in your office to talk with, these you shouldn't, these are the dinners you should go to, these you shouldn't. So we're the gatekeepers, and it's a very coveted position in Washington. It actually makes you a very sought-after person because you're working in the shadows. There's plausible deniability. And they've learned from the previous fiasco of where the most powerful lobbyist in America went to prison. And so that's not going to happen again. He said, so now then I'm told, okay, are you going to get him to agree on that defense appropriation for that particular defense system? And it's a $5 billion system, billion. Now, we don't need it. And 90% of everything in the Defense Department procurement is redundant, and it's just waste of money. But to the private company that has got three generals and an admiral on their board of directors who used to work in the Pentagon, mm-hmm. Defense Department, it's needed. So now you say, okay, and here's what is also said but never put into writing. It's a handshake. You know that another 2 years from now, when all this is done, you're going to leave here and you're going to sign yourself up as an independent consultant. We, my company, the company that I'm here representing, we will see that we hire you for $500,000
to do consulting the first year, a million the second. You also, in the interim, when you're at a particular K Street lobbying firm, you'll be given a Black American Express gold card or a Black American Express credit card, which is, has, I think, an unlimited balance you can run up. You'll be given a car of your choice. You want a BMW, whatever you want, free. And there'll be certain perks about where you can go around the world where we have offices and we also have apartments and suites for people to stay. So you're looking at between a half a million to $1 million a year income indefinitely, in perpetuity. Now, if you do what we're saying, though, nobody will be the wiser and nobody will ever find out this connection. And I said, so this happens, he said, in every single legislator's office in Washington, in every single office in Washington, this is the way it works. And then that's why we have thousands upon thousands of small contractors becoming larger contractors and lobbyists who don't have to sign up as lobbyists. They are now consultants. Billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars change hands. The American public is not aware of this. He said, this is what happens when you go to Washington. And he said, any idealism is bought out of you. That's the word he used. I'd never heard that term before, how idealism can be purchased out of us. And so, and he said, I just want to share this with you because when we hear you railing against corruption in the government and how everything is bought, he said, you have no idea how accurate you are. Could you respond to this concept of the revolving door between people working in agencies like the FDA or the CDC? The head of the CDC, Gerberding, goes to work as head of the vaccine, a major Abbott or one of the major companies, over their vaccine program, and yet she was pro-vaccine when she was at the CDC, refused to look at the danger of vaccines and the autism connection, and now she ends up with a big-paying job over there, and this happens every day in Washington. Your thoughts, please.
Gary, first, let me say that you couldn't have said it any better. I'm serious. It just, everything about that. Two or three days ago, I wrote a piece called Gluttony of American Finance. Gluttony of American Finance. This was, again, a counterpunch. And it concerned exactly what we're talking about. It concerned the provision in that new budget, that $1.1 trillion budget that Obama's about to sign, that very few people really opposed. And when they did oppose, the few who did, Senator Udall, Senator Wyden, one or two others perhaps, it was because a very important provision of the Dodd-Frank banking legislation was being tossed out. And that provision concerned the question of derivatives trading, which is a multi-trillion dollar enterprise. Okay. Now, in going back on this, this is right in the legislation that Obama's now going to sign and so on. What became clear from the articles that I was reading and so on is that you have in the banking, you have the lobbyists, sure. And what the lobbyists are doing is they are, among other things, they are giving dinners for individual legislators to attend these dinners. They named the restaurant several blocks from the Capitol to attend the dinners. The attendees pay a minimum of $2,500. And there are the various banking interests and so on. You do that. You then give all kinds of testimonials where you bring in fundraisers. So the legislator then has a real, a lot of money to work with and so on. And then when you've got all of that, and this is especially for freshman congressmen, because they're going to be very impressionable. You catch them, as you point out, you catch them early and nurse them along. And then when you're ready for the vote on this thing, then who is the one who is calling people, individual congressmen, and urging them to vote? and it's Jamie Dimon of Morgan Chase. And what, you know, poor kid, poor guy, some 40-year-old guy from someplace gets a call from where we learn to genuflect in front of big bankers. We learn, you know, and so on, quaking in our boots, I guess. So you've got the full court press. And the full court press would be the financial community, its lobbyists, its all kinds of goodies that are then carefully administered. It's almost, I guess, like, as I say it, it's like an addiction. You feed something, and then you know, or it's that kind of behavioralism and how Skinner used to work with animals. And you've got these legislators jumping. And in terms of the revolving door itself, it's so completely factually demonstrated. It's funny. It's not funny, but it's also in the career pattern of some. You can start off early, show your prowess as one who favors the interest, then go into the firm or the industry that you've been supporting, and when you've reached a certain level, go back into government, and then from that, it's almost like a staircase in which you can then parlay yourself back to a still greater position within that revolving door complex or syndrome. So it's utter corruption. It's utter cynicism. And the most cynical, the most corrupt, are the ones who most beautifully use the word patriotism. You know, Brecht would never even be able to make it to first base in our society. He'd be overwhelmed. None of the people who have really tried to capture that degree. I don't want to use the word evil because that might have to be, you know, set aside for something more. But it's beyond that. And I'm sorry that the person who spoke with you didn't somehow write this up with a pseudonym. It didn't matter. Get it into a journal that would have readership and so on, and start embarrassing these guys and maybe start putting on the skids to the system itself.
That's what we're hoping for. We're out of time. Thank you very much, Professor Norman Pollack. It's always a joy to have you on because you're so enlightened on these issues and it helps us.
Gary, it's such a pleasure, really. I'm very proud to have been invited on. So thank you so much.
All the best to you.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye. And you could read Professor Pollack's work on Counterpunch. I'm Gary Nall, and this has been a part of our series, a special broadcast, America as a Postmodern Police State.